Honorable members, and to our guests, we are waiting for the chairperson of the Committee on Science and Technology. Let's just give him 5 minutes. Is 5 minutes too much? It is not here with that. Anyone from Science and Technology, because this is supposed to be a joint meeting between higher education and Science and Technology. Anyone from the Committee on Science and Technology? Who is coming? Well, the secretary of the Committee on Higher Education and Training, I think, is still checking on how far is he, because this morning we got confirmation that he will join us. while waiting, Abdu wants us to look at our agenda for the meeting. There are a few changes that I'd like to propose. I'd like us to start with a briefing by the Department of Higher Education and Training on staffing South African universities framework, and then have our discussions, and thereafter then listen to a briefing by the National Research Foundation on funding of postgraduates in South African universities. So if, I'm sure you all have got that. We swap 4 for 6. And then we will have discussions. And then where we had 6, it will be our number 4. I'm sure it's understandable. We thought it would be good that the department give us, you know, an overview. And then we listen, and thereafter. All right. We then, this other briefing will follow, and then we engage in a meaningful discussion flowing from the department's briefing. I am told that Mr. Matale, the acting chairperson, is here. Please, Mr. Matale, very cold up here. I need you here. please join us here. Mr. Matale, we will be co-chairing this meeting. Mr. Matale, say, we are waiting for you. All right, we shall now start. Honourable members and the chairperson from the committee on acting chairperson from the committee on science and technology, shall we open this meeting? Instead of an open prayer, I suggest that we have a moment of silence for prayer and meditation. Shall we close our eyes? Amen. Well, acting chair, honorable members, department, DG and your entourage, and also all the officials from NRF, I'd like to welcome you to this meeting. It is a meeting, it's a joint meeting between the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training and Science and Technology. Let me acknowledge and welcome the acting CEO of the NRF and her team, the DG and departmental officials, media members of the public, and other distinguished guests. I want to thank members of the Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology for accepting the committee's invitation to have a joint meeting, because the topic of discussion is beneficial to both committees. I'd like to acknowledge upfront that NRF reports to the PC on Science and Technology, but it also contributes to the implementation and achievement of Outcome 5, which is a skilled and capable workforce to support an inclusive growth path. Therefore, the Department of Higher Education and Training will not be in a position to achieve the objectives of this outcome without the support of NRF. South Africa has a serious challenge of doctoral graduates, particularly in scarce and critical skills, which are needed for economic growth. Through the NRF initiative, we hope that the National Development Plan target producing more than 5,000 doctoral graduates per annum will be achieved. Well, on the Department of Higher Education on Staffing, South Africa's Universities Framework, the committee would like to commend the department for launching the Staffing South Africa's Universities Framework, abbreviated as SSAUF, which was approved by the minister in February 2015. The committee understands that the framework's imperative is to recruit, support and retain young black academic staff to address their serious underrepresentation at all levels in higher education. During the recent oversight visit of a committee to post-school education and training institution in the Western Cape in July, universities raised concern with the number of posts allocated by the program in comparison with the number of posts they applied for. We hope that the department will expedite the program given the need for training and development of a new generation of academics. With these few words, I would like to thank you and hope that we will have a constructive engagement. Thank you very much. Please feel free, this is our meeting, and let us engage. All right, the next item here is item number 2, which is apologies. Apologies.
Thank you, Chairperson. From the committee, we receive an apology from Mr. Mbatha. He is unable to attend the committee meeting due to other political commitments. And also from the Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology, we receive an apology from the Honorable Mfego, who is attending the lecturer's event. We also receive an apology from the Office of the Minister, who is also unable to attend the meeting due to other commitments. Also, the Office of the Deputy Minister sends us an apology because the Deputy Minister is also attending to another program for people with disabilities. Those are the apologies that were sent to me. Thank you.
Honourable members, we take note of the apologies. We will then move on to introductions. We are now on item number 3. Okay. There's also an apology of the chairperson of the committee on science and technology. Well, starting, let's start with you, Koche.
My name is Kassel Mahalen from the village, member science and technology. Thank you.
My name is Pinky Yvonne Nkwenkwezikosa. I am the chairperson of the portfolio committee on higher education and training. Over to honourable member.
Good morning. My name is Suela Elvis, member of the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Denke Kanade, member of the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education.
Thanks.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Nkadi Ming Frida, member of the committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, Professor Pozoli, Kanavineva.
Professor Pozoli, thank you.
Professor Kubisa, committee member.
Professor Kubisa, thank you.
I'm a member of the Education Board for Higher Education.
Thank you, Honourable Member.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Swangile Ntono, a member of the committee.
Thank you. We will then move over to the department.
Thank you, Professor. My name is Wes Gola from the Department of Higher Education and Training.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Vicky Green from the Department of Higher Education and Training.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Nan Lord, also VHIP.
Thank you. Now we will now move over to NRF.
Good morning, I am Beverly Demons, the acting CEO of NRF.
Thank you.
Good morning, honorable members. I'm Gannon Blair, I'm the Deputy CEO for Research and Innovation for Modern Advancement.
Thank you. I see so many faces and I'm so tempted to ask, for instance, starting from there, going that way. From you, madam.
Good Good morning, honorable members. My name is Peter Matutu from the Department of Science and Technology. I'm the Chief Director of Human Capital and Science Promotion.
I nearly made a mistake.
Yeah.
Key stakeholder. Thank you very much.
Honorable co-chairs, good morning, honorable members. My name is Thomas Ofterheider, Deputy Director General in the Department of Science and Technology, responsible also for human capital development and NRS programs.
Thank you. Yes, this completed. The Office of the Minister,
Melvema Buliana from the Department of Higher Education, the Deputy Minister's Office.
Department of Higher Education, Deputy Minister's Office,
okay.
Shall we take this, the last row there?
Starting from you, sir.
Morning, honorable members. My name is Liana Franz from Ministry of Science and Technology.
Thank you.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Ilya Matikane from the CSIR.
Good morning. My name is Jillian Judith from Cabinet.
Thank you very much. Okay, shall we have that roll? I'm going to have to ask everybody to introduce himself.
Well,
in the process, that's where that leaves our key stakeholders. So I don't know who is sitting here. I'm sure you will all agree with me. Safer that way. Yes, ma'am?
Committee Communications.
Thank you very much. DG's office, thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
Good morning, I'm Asia, Audrey of the ACDC.
Thank you. Yes. Please do me. Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This row, I think this is the last one. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. We now know who is in this meeting, and please, I'm going to once more ask you to feel free so that we can engage meaningfully and, you know, constructively and achieve on the objective of the meeting. We will then move on to item number 4. Remember, I've changed. Number 4 will now be briefing by the Department of Higher Education and Training on staffing South African universities framework. I will request the DG to lead us in this briefing.
So thank you very much, Chair, Co-Chair, members of the Portfolio Committee and the, my colleagues in the department, as well as from NRF and everybody in the house. This question that we are dealing with today, it's quite important in the development of the human resource capacity of our country for economic growth as well as the development of the country in general. And the development or the developmental pathway leading to an academic career, by its very nature, is quite long and is a bit complex. And it gets worsened as the individual program or subject that relates to it. Now, in this sector, we are faced, one, by an aging cohort of academics. Currently, the average age of an academic is around 59, 60 years of age. Now, if we are not putting a very focused and concerted effort in the development and production of academics in the country. In the next 7 years upwards, we may be facing a huge crisis in the country. It is to the extent to which we should actually be looking at this matter. We are losing quite a number of academics through natural attrition, retirement, and in some instances, unfortunately, some would pass away. We are losing academics through immigration as well as other employments outside the academia, industry, you know, and elsewhere. And coupled with that, we are also confronted with a low graduation rate, especially at the doctoral level, you know, in the country. Now, with the objectives and plans of the country with regard to increasing enrollment, now, what becomes quite important to acknowledge is that then the student ratios will worsen if we are not producing enough academics to match that concomitant increases in enrollment in the system as well as in the sector as a whole. So there are those pressures. And you are projecting that the number of new staff in the sector by 2019, we should have produced around 7,000 or so. And this has happened against the background that in 2012, according to the studies that have been conducted, just over one-third of academic staff in permanent positions with doctoral degrees in the system. And in the country, by then, I think the institutions that had more than 50 percent of its academic staff is PhDs. It's about 6 institutions in the country. It's UCT, Stellenbosch, University of Northwest, S, UWC, and Rhodes. Others were having less than that number. So which indicates that in the main, South Africa's numbers of doctoral graduates are very low if compared with other countries. For instance, in the country, we are having 23 per million of population. And in countries which are more or less in the same situation, like ours, for instance, Brazil has got 43 per million of population. South Korea is 157. Australia is around 200. Now, it requires us as a country to design programs to address this sector, which relates to the shortage of academics in the system, and also to be able to address the question of transformation in the system, without of which we won't be able to realize some of the fundamental objectives we want to achieve. It is against this background that then, as a department, there are 2-pronged approaches that were developed. One is to support the current programs that are being administered and managed by National Research Foundation. And we are actually using the National Skills Fund in order to put more resources towards training in that regard. For instance, in the financial year 2015-16, we have allocated just over 153 million in this regard, in support of the programs at the NRF level. But also now, we have developed another program, which we call the new generation of academics in the country, which we are addressing, driving that program in partnership with the institutions themselves and the Department of Higher Education and Training. Now, I'll give over to Dr. Green to take us through the presentation. I thought that background is quite important, and we are very much happy that the portfolio committee is actually itself with this important subject, you know, for the country. So we're glad when we picked up that we are invited to actually engage our leaders on this important matter so that we can really get more advice and more encouragement and critiques where it is actually necessary, because it means so much for the growth of the economy as well as the development of the country. Thank you, Dr. Green.
Thank you, DG. I must agree with you that indeed it was necessary to get this background. And thank you for advising us on the rearrangement of the agenda this morning. Thank you. It makes sense. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and good morning again. Good morning to Honorable Members and to all colleagues. Today is a great privilege for us to bring the portfolio committee on this new program that the Department of Higher Education and Training has initiated. We are really excited about this. I think it's going to be able to make quite a significant contribution to the academic staffing context at universities over the next few years, but realize very much that we are at the beginning stages and there is much to learn, much to grow, and we'll be very happy to take all the advice that we can from the committee as we go forward. I'm going to present a part of the presentation, and Professor Yell will also present a part focused on the MGAP program. The Director General has pointed to the range of issues that have underpinned our decision to implement the program, such as the staffing South African universities framework. These include equality of representation amongst existing staff, the demographic profile does not reflect what we hope we would be able to see in a democratic South Africa 21 years after the release of apartheid. The unequal or unfavorable staff ratios that prevail in institutions, in some institutions more than others. The low group of rates that prevail across the system generally, but more problematic again in some institutions more than others. The issue of qualifications and expertise of existing staff in institutions, and the issue of growing a postgraduate pipeline in order both to provide for a new generation of academics, but also to provide for the human resource capacity needs in the country in general. I have included some slides that point to data in relation to this. This data has been drawn from the framework document itself, which was circulated to the committee members. But I thought I'd just point to them so that if there are any questions around the rationale for the program itself, we can use that as some sort of justification. I think we have to emphasize up front, and the DG has made quite clear, that the university system is diverse. It's varied. And we have a range of different universities in the system where contexts are different. And any approaches that we implement to address issues at universities have to become more and more nuanced as we go forward. We have to address the issue of what's happening in historically disadvantaged universities and how we support those universities to make the growth that's needed for them to make the contribution that's expected of them in the country. So if you look at the issue of inequality of representation amongst existing staff, this gives you a profile of demographics from 2003 to 2012, and it's a breakdown in relation to race. One can see quite clearly that there is significant underrepresentation of black academics, and particularly African and Canada academics. The numbers in relation to total proposal, to total number is low. So it's one of the motivations behind the staffing South African universities framework, to grow the academic staffing cohorts at universities so that it becomes more democratically representative of the South African population. So there is a focus on black, African, and women as we implement the program to grow the profile of those academics in the institutions. The other issue is the low throughput rates. The PhD is able to internally conduct cohort studies. We have developed a capacity, and so we can follow cohorts of students overall in different programs, but even within programs. The cohort studies are different from the cohort studies, for example, that are conducted by the CHD utilizing a variety of people, because the PhD cohort studies focuses on dropouts from the system rather than dropouts from specific programs. So when PhD talks about cohort studies, they talk about whether people are still in the system, the higher education system, the university system or not. Be it as it may, the cohort studies do pose a worrying picture that we have higher rates of dropouts, more than the country can afford, and that we need to improve retention of students and completion rates of students across the range of programs, from the 3-year diplomas right up to the doctorates. There is a need for improvement in relation to retention and graduation. So this is one of the rationales behind the Staffing South African Universities framework, then, to increase the capacity of staffing institutions so that the service they deliver to students can improve in quality. The qualifications and expertise of existing staff, DG also pointed to this, are very varied picture across the system. So some universities are much better than others. So for example, UCT in 2012 had 65% of its staff, academic staff, holding doctorates, as compared to, for example, an institution like Mangosuthu University of Technology, which had 9%. So a wide variance between institutions and a need then to target, implement targeted initiatives to address challenges at specific institutions. We need to increase the postgraduate pipeline. Particularly again in terms of the race profile of our postgraduate students. So we're certainly not reducing the number of postgraduates we need in the country, and there are patterns in relation to the demographics that need to be addressed. So the DHET has consulted widely with the sector and has drawn on a lot of prior work that has been done by a range of people, including the University of South Africa, Women's School Lisa, much work that they did around a new generation academics program. And we incorporated a lot of this work into the Staffing South African Universities framework. So really not reinventing the wheel, but building on a lot of good work, solid work, that actually was done in the system prior to this, but expanding it significantly in different ways. We took the decision intentionally upfront to focus not just on a new generation of academics, but to focus on the entire academic pipeline and to look at leverage points through the pipeline where we can work to strengthen the availability of high-quality academics in South African universities. So if you look at that pink arrow structure running down, trying to understand that academics move through a pathway from honors to doctoral, to postdoctoral work into an early academic career and need support all along the way. And if we're going to grow a pipeline that is sustainable and provides for adequate numbers of academic staff in our institutions, we have to focus on all levels of that pipeline. So the Staffing South African University framework is actually made up of 5 programs embedded within it. And these programs target different points in that pipeline. So, for example, the Nurturing Emerging Scholars program is targeting the beginning of the pipeline and is focused on encouraging high achievers who may have aspirations or who could be encouraged to consider embarking on an academic career and to start supporting them, even from the latter stages of the undergraduate degrees and the first stage of their postgraduate studies, to start utilizing them in different ways in universities, for example, through structured tutorship and mentorship programs that draw these potential new academics into an environment where they start to be encountered into what makes up an academic career. And the new generation of academic program at this point is a big component of the staffing South African University's framework, and is intended to recruit academics. At the master's level, largely, and at the PhD level, and at the postdoctoral level. And to right up front, ensure that those new recruits are employed permanently at the institutions, and that they receive support over a period of 6 years to become engaged as early career academics in the system. The third program is the existing academics capacity enhancement program. So we have academics in the system. These academics need development, they need support, either in terms of the teaching, in terms of the research capacity, in terms of the community development outreach capacity, or across all of those. And this program would seek to provide that support. I think we have to make it, to emphasize up front that Staffing South African Universities program is focused on developing academics across all the roles that academics need to play. So it's about teaching, it's about research, and it's about outreach. All those three roles. Very much focused on ensuring that we get good teachers, good researchers, who are embedded in communities and contexts. Two support programs support the three core programs. And those two support programs are on the right-hand side, the South Africa University Development Program. So it's a cross-cutting program that will tie into each of these three core programs. And it would serve to provide the development opportunities for the emerging scholars, for the new generation of academics, for the existing academics. So we have activities such as postgrad workshops, or activities such as enrolling for a formal qualification around teaching, a postgraduate diploma in university teaching. A whole range of different kinds of activities that different academics could embark on depending on their personal needs. And then on the left-hand side, again, a cross-cutting program that talks on the issue of utilizing staff that might not be permanently located in institutions, but can be drawn on to support what's happening in the institutions. So, for example, utilizing vibrant, retired academics who've developed a strong research profile in particular areas, and using those academics to nurture the new academics that come along. So, for example, making linkages between universities and industry so that we get bench places in laboratories for the new academics that are emerging. So trying to create cross-linkages would start in other places so that academic staff at universities can be developed. So in a nutshell, that's the Staffing South African University framework. At this point in time, we have embarked strongly on implementing the new generation of academics program. And the other programs are being implemented through what's implicit present, the teaching development grants and the research development grants. As we go forward into the next cycle of funding, and once the review of funding of universities is finalized, we are going to have a new grant in the system called the University Development Grant, which is proposing a much more holistic approach to development at universities. And that grant will become the major vehicle through which we try to start the South African Universities framework. So we are seeing that the funding for this framework is critical. There's two dependencies here that are critical. One is the funding, and two is the human resources capacity. But the funding for implementation of the framework will come through three sources. One, through streamlining funding in the system that is already targeting these variety of purposes so that they become the lever through which the Staffing South African University framework is addressed. The other one is through creating partnerships with a whole range of organizations who have similar goals to the Staffing South African University framework. So, for example, Prof. will talk about a potential collaboration with the NRF around the new generation of academics program. We are making linkages with a whole range of organizations that offer scholarships for academics at universities so that we can align those scholarships to support of the new generation of academic program. Erasmus Mundus, Erasmus Plus, has now been reconceptualized, offers great potential for collaboration and partnership. So that would be another sort of funding, seeing partnerships across the system and coordinating funding towards a common goal that will strengthen and maximize impact. Third area is new funding. If we're going to go to scale, we are going to need new funding in the system. And the VAGP will seek to make MTA bids as those possibilities arise, but also look for example, partnerships with CISA and the National Skills Fund in terms of supporting and growing the implementation of the Starting South African University Framework. I'm going to stop there and probably now Nan will take over.
Thank you, sir. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. What I'm going to try and do is say, so that's the plan. How far have we got? What are we learning? And how do we hope to go forward? So you can see the major components, as Dr. Green has said, really focuses on the first three, which is new staff, additional part-time staff, and also improving the effectiveness of currently employed staff. And the teaching development grants, the research development grants, et cetera, are dealing precisely with that number C. But also, in our working with earmarked grants in particular, we've become acutely aware that for many institutions, actually managing and getting the maximum benefit from the earmarked grants, teaching development, research development, et cetera, has been a real issue. And so we're wanting to add to the framework what is number D here, which is really trying to say it's not only the people who are actually teaching students in class that make a difference to the conditions of learning in the classroom. It's all the people who manage the processes, who manage the financial aid offices, who manage the institutional research offices, etc. So we are trying to do something about, and the teaching and learning centers indeed, something about a capacity development program which has a number of components, and we're hoping to launch that actually at the end of this year with first cohorts, and so I think that will make a big difference, certainly to strengthen institutions' capacity to run academic programs. So can I talk now a little bit about the NGAP process, the new generation, and just to say to you how it works, because universities are invited to apply for posts, but they have to do so on very carefully specified grounds. One, equity. Two, need for the post. And crucially, three as well, sustainability. Equity, as we all know, is a real issue to change the professoriate in the long term. Need, some areas where it's really been very difficult to recruit fully-fledged academics. So this is an opportunity to start lower down with more junior staff. And sustainability, because this is a cost-sharing exercise in the long term. These are permanent posts. And that's the second bullet. And whereas I'm sure you're aware that a lot of money has gone into the system over the years into trying to grow our own timber kind of projects. One of the fatal flaws of those projects has been that they've tended to be contract positions. And the attrition rate from those contracts into becoming permanent posts has been very high. So I think that many of the foundations are tended to be donor-funded as well. So this NGAP process sets up right from the beginning saying, these are permanent posts, and universities, it's up to you in partnership to make sure that these young people are inducted comprehensively so that they can succeed. And I just wanted to share with you that actually going around the sector, consulting on this program, etc., that was quite a hard thing to win because many institutions would say, we don't want to actually take a risk on permanence. So when you're so young and relatively untested. And we said, this is actually a non-negotiable. And universities need to have robust performance management systems for when they make mistakes for all this stuff. This is no different. Anyway, that was finally agreed. Then there's a review committee that looks at all those. So we had hundreds of applications from universities. It was really very encouraging. Remember, this is the third intake. And the review committee, it was not their job to say, this university needs those posts. What they had to do was look at the applications and say, we are convinced that this is a sustainable post, that the equity is serious,
and against the equity plan. And just to say, the MGAP posts are funded on the sliding scale over 6 years. Right, and I was going to come to that now. Just, I couldn't put the whole advertisement on a slide. It would have got too small, but I don't know if you saw it, but in the newspapers there were big full pages. All the universities, you can see the logos around the frame, and then you can just see some of the universities, but all 26 universities obviously got posts, and they were all listed there, and then applicants go to websites to apply. Remember that DHEC doesn't appoint academic staff. Universities appoint academic staff. Just a snapshot, what did the universities ask for and what allocated? You can see here that predominantly the biggest numbers are in science, engineering, health science. This is of the posts that they asked for. In future iterations and future phases of the NGAP, it might well be that some central steering will be necessary if we want to, for example, build social science and humanities, etc. But in the first one or two iterations, it was to really see what institutions felt were their real needs, where they did not have black academics in particular, young people as well. So, Katherine talked about the development program, and that's central to this. And just to spend a couple of minutes on this, you can see the two phases. So NGAP really stretches, it's a permanent post, but it stretches over 6 years, and then it's like any other academic post. Obviously, it has employment. In that, post holders have reduced teaching loads, because they are almost all going to be studying for a PhD or master's. And not, of course, at the institution where they have a post necessarily, can be, but just like now you don't have to. There will be assigned a mentor. There will be short courses, as Dr. Green said, on research and teaching development. There will be an international mobility experience that will be organized and negotiated with these young academics right from the get-go. And infrastructure and equipment, some contributions towards costs. You can see here, obviously, the synergies with the NRF, and I'm sure you're going to speak about that, and I can touch on that as well. But, for example, research and teaching development and PhD and master studies, those two aims are absolutely congruent with our values in the NRF. And we have been in discussions whereby we are working with the NRF so that they can share some of the research costs, the research development and research costs of these young academics, while we are paying for their salary and the teaching development components. So that's in process. Let me give a quick update. So the first phase was the first 125, as I showed you the pie at Bath. Universities are currently conducting interviews. In fact, the first appointments have been completed. I think about the first 16, and today I think there's something like 18 interviews going on, so they really are rolling out now. The development program will begin to roll out in February 2016. The next round of NGAP posts, the call will go out in October for an intake in 2016. This is meant to be an annual, and just remember that this is not meant to replace the kinds of recruitment that universities do. They still need to be recruiting their professors and their staff, etc. This is meant to be something in addition. Some universities have requested actually to fund additional MGAP posts to swell numbers for the system, where the department would pay the development program costs and the universities would pay the salary components. But they have said, and we still need to work out exactly how that will happen in this second phase, but it would certainly assist in growing the numbers there. Just we wanted to share with you very briefly some of the questions, some of our sort of thinking about this very seriously now. What are some of the systemic constraints? And we heard our DG and Dr. Green talking about this. How do we ensure that an academic career is attractive enough to draw the brightest young people? We can't possibly have one group of young academics earning three times of another group. So, you know, it's just not possible to sort of double. I mean, salary is never going to be the thing that gets people into academia. But how do we make sure that the rest of it is attractive enough? How, this is a critical one, the second one, how do we ensure that all universities can provide a robust and high-quality academic environment in which young academics can thrive? You saw the table with the number, the percentage of PhDs. Now, a PhD is not immediately a proxy for quality of teaching, learning, research, etc., but that's a very good indication if it's very low, that there are problems. How do we, in contexts where there is a low number, make sure that the young academics starting there nevertheless have a rich and nurturing and retained? And then third, of course, to ensure that meaningful and comprehensive transformation is developed so that current apparent barriers to retention, etc., are dealt with, because it is no good bringing in bright young people who hit the same barriers that has meant that we've been losing so many talented stuff. So how do we do that? But at the same time, dealing on with this process, because we can't sit back and say, let's wait till the system, you know, is transformed. Very brief update on some of the other SSAUS framework components. I mentioned that the new university capacity program planned, targeting staff like this, directors of teaching learning centers, student affairs, student housing, etc. We think that that has really been the missing group. How do we roll out the development program, which is currently in self-development, to roll up early next year? How do we expand it so that, in fact, particularly what Dr. Green was talking about, young tutors, who are obviously a pool, possible pool, how do we include them? Because we're talking big numbers there, so that's a challenge. The synergies are being developed with the NRS capacity building programs, which is, I won't read this all, you can see their research support and costs. These are planned to take immediate effect from the beginning of next year, so we need to do some more discussion on that and so that. And the other components of this are being rolled out at the moment in a different form through the teaching development grant, research development grants, but as capacity, our capacity grows in this regard, we can begin to roll out those in a more streamlined way. And just coming to the end of it, Mr. Green did mention the university development grant. And as is planned, the big cycle of earmarked grants for university development of academic processes comes to an end in 16-17, so this would be after that. And SSAUF will then actually become the major vehicle for research and teaching development. And just to say also that it's very, to date, the foundation provision earmarked grants have not actually been drawn into the university development activities, and we believe that they should come in as a critical part of the throughput at the early stages, which impacts on all later stages. And yes, and we believe this will bring greater coherence, efficiency and effectiveness. And that's my bit. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Honourable members, it is now time for us to reflect, interrogate and discuss the presentation by the Department of Higher Education and Training. Professor Kozoli, Professor Kubisa, Honourable Member Ngalime, Honourable Member Killian, Honourable Member Mkunu, Honourable Member Suela and Honourable Member Gitana, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your presentation. You acknowledge, DG, that there is a looming crisis in higher education. The sort of Eskom moment, the cold cliff of higher education is coming. And my main comment on this presentation is it's all very nice and wonderful, but it's not going to solve problems. Because if you're saying in 7 years' time, hundreds of staff in the most senior positions in universities who do all the research, I mean the majority of the research, are going to be retiring and have already been retiring at quite a rate, how are people aged 20 going to solve that problem? I just don't see how the two match. What you need is senior people in universities. Is there any plan to import academics like they do in countries like Saudi Arabia? They've done it in China. They've done it in all sorts of places, Botswana, in order to fill the senior positions that are going to go and in order to continue performing the research that is going to need to be performed. Secondly, not only is this not going to address the cliff that's facing us, But the program, wonderful as it is too small for what is needed. I mean, I calculated from the CAE presentation last week that while student numbers went up from 480,000 to 980,000, that's a half a million increase in 20 years, staff went up by 5,000 in the country as a whole. So in 20 years, we only had 5,000 more staff, and our staff-student ratios went up from 39, which was already high, to 55, which is the current for permanent staff I'm talking about. So if you're actually going to address the staffing crisis in universities, we're talking about a massive investment in new staff. Is such an investment being considered on a far bigger scale than the one that is being proposed? Thirdly, the fact that universities have to take over these academics once they finish their sort of probation years, well, they're not getting more money to do that. So how can this be seen as a new initiative? It's all it is replacing the existing staff in 5 years' time. It's not actually giving people new posts. So again, the problem of not enough new posts is simply going to continue, although it's being postponed. So what scheme does the department have in order for actual new positions to be provided permanently to universities so that they can avoid this the cliff? Thank you.
Thank you for the issues that you raised, Honorable Professor Kubisa.
Definitely, I know it fall from what the presentations that have been given. One major challenge Jefferson, with regard to attracting academics at university, is the issue of salaries. You find that there is a huge gap between, say, a junior lecturer, lecturer, senior lecturer, head of department, and there's a huge gap there compared to the salary that is earned by the executive dean, for instance. And from the executive dean, director general, there's another huge gap between the salary of a executive dean and that of a deputy vice chancellor. Another gap again between the deputy vice chancellor and the vice chancellor. So, and you find that a lecturer, for instance, a junior lecturer with income subjects can be easily taken by the private sector, because with some universities, a big bonus lecturer or junior lecturer and teach course one students. That lecturer can easily be taken by the private sector because he or she might be head of accounting 3, for instance, or economics 3, can be easily staged by the private sector. So there's a gap there. And then I also fully agree with you that there is need at university for support services, laboratories, which were previously there, but some universities have become less with regard to having these laboratories, academic development centers, which I didn't. Because what I also observe is that the caliber or the quality of students that we have cannot cope with the university studies. They cannot articulate themselves, so they need a lot of support, academic support within the university. That support, which could be in the form of counseling, psychological, attitudinal, so that they can extend themselves to their studies. That's why, therefore, I say I fully agree with the support services that the department is obtaining. Because to me, that is very important, because you find that most of our students cannot express themselves. I have seen graduates with degrees who really fail to express themselves, which means that there is a real problem there. So I therefore venture to say, submit that you consider the issue of investing more on issues of support, attitudinal support, when students are there, because so they can exert themselves, change their attitudes, also connect with the senior secondary phase, or with high schools, or with FETs, or with community colleges, because students had entered these super universities or FETs, from FETs to universities. So far, the last one, Director General, which has been very disturbing of late, you find that lecturers or academics are recruited to universities, recruited, played. After some time, you find that that person does not have requisite skills or the necessary qualifications. A person is recruited, purportedly the person says, I got a PhD, I've got a master's degree. After some time, you find that there was sort of ineptitude or laxity in trying to trace the qualifications from the beginning. That has been another problem. Chairperson, thank you very much. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Member. The next one will be Honorable Member Gadime.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me start by welcoming the presentation. My question is there any contract that has been signed between the DHET universities and the beneficiaries of the NGAP to make sure that they work for a specific period before they can resign? Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will now move on to Honorable Member Keegan.
Chairperson, at least Honorable Gadibene has asked my one question. but can I just first of all thank you to the department and for the presentation, particularly because I would like to first of all know if there is any other country that you have followed as a model to actually encourage the development of academics. Is there any other country that had a similar problem? Or is it peculiar to South Africa? And is it, you know, if you have any idea about the reason why we face that particular challenge. Secondly, I would like to go to your slide 3. And that is the inequality of representation amongst existing staff. Just understanding that this refers to research and instruction staff, to lecturers, just an idea, does this include contract staff as well? And what is the ratio between contract staff and permanent staff? Because you have said that was one of the weaknesses in the past. If you could just give us an idea. In relation to that particular slide and with reference to the Council for Higher Education presentation last week, my recollection is that the figure was probably updated. Maybe it's not exactly the same period, but I thought it was slightly different. They had, well, if you calculated the ratio between students and staff, lecturing staff, it moved from about 44 to about 55. So there was certainly a growing number of students in relation to the number of lecturing staff. And they have also said that they could give us a further breakdown of figures to indicate, because in some cases some subjects would have bigger classes without a problem and others would require smaller class with more direct supervision, for instance in science, etc. Then, I just wanted to know on slide 5, and it maybe links on to what you have said in relation to the huge difference between, for instance, Mangosuthu University of Technology and UGT. But what drives poor retention rates? Now, Professor Kubisa has said that it certainly there's an element of salary, inequality, etc. But is it money, or is it work conditions, sort of environmental, academic environment that is complex without the necessary support? What is really behind that? Because sometimes you have the impression that if you have a passion for that sort of sphere of work, then it's not always. But do you have any figures? Is it possible to determine that? I have noted in one of your presentations that we received yesterday that they referred to how difficult it is to track those students who have qualified where they go to in the workplace. It's not always possible. But do you have any idea? And then, lastly, your program, have you developed it in close collaboration with the university? Have you had any feedback on them, from them? Why they have lost or they have been unable to produce more a pipeline for doctorate and postgraduate, postdoctoral studies? Chairperson, I think that concludes my question. I just wanted to understand the exposure to international research and academic opportunity is wonderful, but I think that is where I wanted to know that we make sure that we also link them to some other contract so that they are not then again picked up, which often happens to us. We produce so many doctors and then we lose them to other countries. So how do we make sure that we in fact retain the expertise of people who have been put through our universities? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Member Killian, for your intervention. I will now call upon Honourable Member Mkhulu.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. May I thank the DG for the presentation that they had for the rationale of the program, because it tells us, it really makes sense when you understand where we're coming from as a country and where we're going. I'd like to ask Dr. Green. He referred to academic supported to enroll for postgraduate diploma in education for university teaching. I would like to know whether this diploma is existing. If not, is it something that the department is planning on introducing? May I also express, with all the three programs, I really support the new generation of academics program. It says to us we are developing our own. I'm not for the idea of importing more academics, but we want to ensure that we develop our own as South Africa as a country. In your presentation, it is indicated that teaching loads of NGAP candidates will be reduced. How will the department monitor that all the candidates are adequately afforded the opportunity trained and that they are not overloaded with teaching work by professors who want to do research? We want them to have more time so that they are able to complete their studies. On slide 3, the last one, Chair, where there is an analysis of inequality of representation amongst existing staff, I would like to know whether, because we have seen that there are 125 posts that have been advertised, allocated to all universities, I believe. I would like to know whether this post or this program is biased towards the black, African and women, the academics with disabilities, and historically disadvantaged universities. In terms of your allocation, these are the 125 posts that you have. How have you ensured that they are biased towards the three groups that I have mentioned? I thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. We now call upon Honourable Member Suela.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. And thank you to the department for the presentation. Now, the NGAP program is obviously a welcome development, and particularly that those that will come through the program will be deemed permanent. But being permanent does not necessarily mean that these court employees, new staff, will stay in the system. What is the government's plan to make sure that these people remain in the system? Are there ways and means to improve perhaps their working conditions to make sure that
the main community, because otherwise we can come with these programs, put them into the system, but if there's no improvement in that regard, the likelihood is that they will leave in search of greener pastures. The other issue that I want to raise is that we're talking of this stuff, this stuff to be developed and so on, which is also welcome. Because when you look at one of the slides, we have a high dropout rate. Perhaps that should also speak to the quality of teaching that these students receive in the university, or the support and advice that they are receiving from their lecturers or their professors. Because we continue to lament that we have got very few students that are graduating, masters or PhD. Perhaps one thing that we should look into is the quality of the support that they are receiving from their supervisors. The university, in slide 13, requested to fund additional and get post to solve their numbers for the system. Obviously, this will add value, and this a strong buy-in, as you said. I think the universities also should be commended for their gesture, because then if this is granted, and obviously it will reduce the workload of the academic staff, but also improve the chances of the students succeeding. Finally, Chair, I want to know, the next round of NGAPOS will begin October 2015. How many? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Member Swell. I will now call upon Honorable Member Ketana.
Chair, thanks to the DG once more for the introductory overview. I found that, like Premier said, to be pointing in the right direction we are going. Chair, mine is mainly on the international field, like other members have pointed out. I just want to know, for example, the issue of people in academics staff being attracted by private sector. The point is that South Africa is not the only country with private sector. Our models are actually in line with what is happening in private sector in first world, in developed countries. Now, what are experiences there? How are people able to retain good academics, especially in those subjects that are competing with what is there in private sector, in the sciences, in commerce, because these are shared by private sector and public sector. I mean, the point is, again, there's no way that we're going to compete with private sector in this country. I mean, if the CEO of ShopRite at one stage and 48 million annual income, I don't see any principal of university, even the president of the country, earning 48 million. So we can't compete with private sector, but how are Western countries coping with this very issue, because we actually modeled alongside the same ways of development of developed countries. That's the first point. The second point, look, there is already an existing policy, even in companies or tenders, where it is said, get local people for jobs, but where they are not local skills, you are able to take them from outside. Outside meaning the immediate environment, like rural neighborhood, if there's a mine there, but if there's no engineer in that particular village, take it outside, even from the urban area or wherever you can get it. So even for academics, I just want to find out, because indeed the question remains that in the interim, while we're developing our own and we hope we can catch up, those that come from outside, especially those that come funded, I mean, we do have students from Zimbabwe coming to master's PhD here. The government of Zimbabwe is paying for their education. Now, especially in the hard sciences, how are we performing because as an interim, somebody teaching must continue, and somebody must do the teaching. And I know that with Japan, this is the last question. With Japan professor, a late professor at Missouri, I like quoting him, because he used to say, Japan borrowed science and technology from the West, but they retained their culture. This is because a lot of when Japan was developing, and Japan is a giant today outside Europe, in the G7. When Japan was developing, a lot of scientists and professors and academics came from Germany, who were there early during the Second World War, as we know. But they came from Germany, and they taught in Japan, and when they went back to Japan, was there to continue science and technology in their development, in industries, in the economy that is creating jobs for them, and today Japan. So in a sense, somewhere in the process of development, you'll need other people who have the capacity to help if you don't have it yourself. Thanks, Chair. I would just like to hear comments there.
Thank you so much for all the questions, relevant questions that you have asked. I will now request the Department of Higher Education and Training to respond.
No, yes, thank you, Chair. I think perhaps it's important to share with the committee that the kind of intervention that we have come up with as a department is born out of elaborate studies, engagements, research with the entire sector. And we had quite elaborate engagements and work together with HISA in this regard, amongst others, and including individual universities across the country. So we're not talking here about some tagging of the work that we needed to do. And one of the decisions that we have arrived at was that it's not going to help the sector nor the country to confine ourselves in a more finger quantification or blame game about what we are finding in the system at the present moment. We then work out our minds around what would be the adequate response to all these challenges that we're picking up. We agreed that we have to develop a strategy whose purpose is to set out ways in which the sector's staffing needs can be met quite holistically. And in that process, we identify what are the potential blockages for unlocking. I think it's quite important to sketch this scenario in addressing this matter, because the members are asking quite important questions. We then moved into saying, we require, among other things, a focused and concerted effort in order for us to be able to address all these questions. One, we need to improve representativity. Hence, this program is prescribing that 80% of these new academics should be drawn from amongst blacks. But I think members would be quite able to realize that thus far, it has been 100%. We need to unblock the blockages along the educational route. And the strategies into doing that, we addressed with the institutions themselves and came up with the projections that if this is addressed, this is how much that we would be able to produce in this institution. And we then had as to what could be
total figure from the overall performance of the system. There's an indication that by 2021, about 3,500 academies would actually be retiring. And in order to make up for that, the numbers that were worked together with the institution is that we should be able to make up at least 6,000 posts by that time if we are to stay quite in shape. But I'll come back to that question. The other area is that we actually need to put resources and support in order to shorten the time to completion of a doctoral program, because at the present moment is a bit longer. So we identified those blockages together with the system. We need to increase the supervisory capacity in the system, and the practical and concrete measures that we are taking together with institutions in addressing that. Of course, we need to address funding constraints and ensure that as we are doing this work, we are not recruiting the agents to become PhD graduates, because we'll be defeating the purpose. We should target young and upcoming youth who will be able to stay for long, you know, in the system. Now, Dr. Green spoke on the question of funding. We are making funding available from within the resources. We steer the allocation of those funds in order to address this question. The question of partnerships, I think he spoke on that, and it has come right very well in respect to it. But what we also put to institutions is the importance of working out strategies to retain academics who are there. And the institutions individually are actually working in that respect at the present moment, and there are positive signs already. Institutions have in actual fact committed into increasing quite substantially what the department is putting. For instance, the investment of Stellenbosch, it has increased by 3 times of the number of students in these programs to those that have been offered by the department. So it's quite encouraging, and it's not the only institutions. But I think over and above what we would actually be doing, yes, we would need to support each and every institution to realize this, but also it would be important, in my view, to hold each institution to account on their performance, all of them. And we should not allow excuses from each and every institution, because each institution is populated by the academics who have to perform a certain duty for those institutions as well as for the country. I think the question of holding our institutions to account, all of them, and we do not allow excuses that are more meaningless to be a blockade in us in achieving what we have to achieve. I will ask my colleagues to come in some pertinent questions, but I thought perhaps it's quite important to set the record straight as to the background to the development of this strategy was actually preceded by elaborate studies, research, and a well-considered graphic of the program with targeted interventions in respect to addressing all the blockages in the system of all sorts.
Thanks, DG. I think there's a clear recognition from the department that the program has to be scaled up to better meet the needs of the system. And the intention over the next few years is that we move to an intake of 400 a year, and then over the 3 years of the program had 2,400 in-gap recruits at any one time busy with participating in the program. Certainly, it's not going to solve the entire problem. It's part of the solution. it has to complement, as Prof. Yana said, university recruitment activities and not stop those. In fact, those have to be upscaled as well. I think funding the system DG has addressed, the Ramaphosa Commission also addressed the issue of insufficient funding and the need to grow that, and certainly the DIGD is working to do that. I think the issue of academic salaries versus salaries in the private sector is a conundrum that exists across the world and impacts on us in South Africa as well. We're never going to be able to match, but I think what we have to try and do is to get the value add of an academic career much more highly profiled and to come much more to the fore, so that through the value add of an academic career, academics see the traction. So, for example, the possibility of in the NGAP program, the possibility of strong development right through your career trajectory would be a value add. So you're not left in isolation on your own, and there are development opportunities that align to career progression and promotion opportunities would be one example. Another example would be the possibility of mobility experiences, research and travel. So there are some things that potentially make an academic career attractive, and I think we need to focus on those and more highly profile them. I think the issue, I'm going to leave the issue of the contract to Prof. Held, I'm sure you'll address that directly. I'm also going to leave the issue of the teaching development, what we're doing to support existing students, understanding the needs of our existing current students coming into the system, and how we're supporting the problem. We'll address that. We certainly have taken into account what's happening in the countries in the construction of this process. It hasn't been something that's been dumped out of a couple of officials sitting at the DHET. It's really been collaboration with the sector, with universities South Africa through area groupings with individual universities and based on what is in the literature in terms of models such as this. I think this issue around the question that was specifically directed to me around the PG gap for university teaching. The university teaching is a component of the PG gap. So a PG gap would be a postgraduate diploma in higher education in the university sector. And it's kind of a whole range of issues, including research development, including some teaching development opportunities. There are a number. You will be aware that EduQSF was recently promulgated in 2013, and universities are currently creating programs aligned to EduQSF. A number of universities have already passed through the HE and have got accreditation for the postgraduate diploma specifically in the higher education, including some components of university teaching. You know, I think those are issues I'd like to listen from the other panelists.
Do you want to talk up? Certainly. Thank you. Very briefly, just to pick up, yes, contracts. How do we make sure that this considerable investment actually doesn't just go into the land? Every postholder signs when they accept an offer, an addendum of agreement with the university and the university with DHET. There will be penalties if there's any poaching, and many institutions are extremely worried about that they have very good NGAP and somebody, another university would poach them away. There will be penalties, just like bursary schemes where you pay back development components. And so, yes, there is a contract. I want to say this is about how do we retain academics. I mean, if we had the answer to that in the world, it would be it's a very, very tricky thing. I think, from my understanding, if we had a more transparent career path and track that was understood by young academics right in the beginning, and that's what we're trying to put in place through the NGAP, but generally in the system. If you're a young person, how can your career look? You know, what can it look like? And to try and make them more explicit. Young people sort of bumble into this career, and it's easy to get deflected. That's my view. We are really trying to create those career paths. It's very opaque at present. Dr. Green asked me to say something about teaching development grants and how we're trying to address problems. I'll be very brief on this because it's a big investment. It's about 640 million a year going into programs, for example, trying to make academics more effective teachers and learners. Some are obviously extremely effective, but trying to develop that. Trying to do something like tutoring and mentoring. Trying to make sure that all first-year students have a mentor. And therein lies a challenge as well, because a bad mentor is worse, I think, than no mentor. So how do we actually train and get good mentors in?
how do we do proper research into learning and teaching so we understand why students struggle, what kind of things make a difference. But I did want to mention we also have collaborative grants. And we are funding big consortia to develop PG postgraduate diplomas in teaching, learning, research, development, the different components, and management and leadership. Also first-year experience, big projects, some very successful initiatives there. I think that was that. I think, was that, was you in also should cover?
Maybe just an issue of disability didn't pick up on
that.
And it is something we haven't highlighted in this first iteration of the NCAP. But I think something that you should pick up directly in the next iteration to focus on the recruitment of potential academic disability and to utilize programs as a vehicle also to provide opportunities in that area.
Just in conclusion, Jay, I just want to say properly, I absolutely agree with this. Is this enough? No. We know that the system actually requires more funding, but you can't not start doing something because it's not enough. So we're hoping that, in fact, we're starting something here that will actually get momentum and make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the responses, honourable members. Do you have follow-up questions? Professor Kozoli, honourable member Suela, honourable member Killian, honourable member... Yes. Professor, you will be the last one of this. Am I reading the situation correctly? Listen to your face, your eyes. You're okay. Okay, thank you very much. In that order.
Thank you very much, and thanks for all your answers. I'm still a little unclear as to the numbers, because the DG mentioned 6,000. Then there was 250 a year, then there was 200 a year, then you mentioned 2,400. So I'm just wondering if we could have a clear indication how many a year are coming into the scheme and how many do you predict will drop out? Presumably you've done estimates on that. So at the end of whatever the period, and how long is the scheme going to last? And at the end of the period, how many new academics will we have? And will they have new hosts to go into, or will they fill old posts? I read that they will fill old posts. And then my second simply comment is, nobody's saying don't do it, but don't claim that it's a solution to the cliff that's coming. Because the cliff that's coming is going to kill our research, and the junior academic will not be able to do the level of research that those who are retiring do. And so it may fill classrooms of people who can teach first year, but it's not going to fulfill one of the most important things that a university does, and that is original work. And that tends to be dominated by the more mature academics. At 25 or 28, somebody's only just finished their PhD, and they can't be seen as the big publishers. It's just not really realistic to pose this as a solution to the retirement problem. It may be a solution to other problems, but not to that one. Thank you.
Professor Pozzoli, it will be honourable member Suela.
Thank you, Chairperson. I wanted to know how many MCAP positions are available for 2016. Unfortunately, that was not answered. But in addition to that, I would like to know what happens if somebody who is in the program decide to withdraw, will the position be filled? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Member Killian.
Honourable Suela covered my question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Kubisa.
Yes, Chair. I just wanted to comment the department on the initiative that they've taken really to try and ameliorate this kind of a situation. You see, the NGAP program is such a good program because we're facing a lot of problems in universities with regard to attracting academics. But I also not Chairperson, but there's another huge problem when it comes to the student dropout. And perhaps it's related to the issue of accommodation. We welcome the whole idea of city universities, and the problem of accommodation is another issue that causing a lot of damage to our students. And these students lodge in towns and cities, and there's absolutely no control. And this has a huge bearing, again, Director General, on the dropout, where you put in a lot of money and you invest a lot of money into a career of a student, but only find there where they are because there is no control. They roam about in towns and cities, and that has a bearing, but it causes a very high failure rate. So that's another issue. Another problem, which is perhaps beyond your control, I don't know whether it's within your control, the issue of a student who would have the initial money to pay, to register. On the fact that later on there is no money to pay, that has a bearing again on the psychological part of the student, and as far as not paying on time. So I wanted to ask whether you could do something with regard to that one, because I've seen that has a huge effect. It looks rather very fundamental, but it has an effect. Investing a lot of money in the careers of students, but I don't find that they don't exempt themselves. They easily miss. Thank you.
Then follow up on the department to respond to the follow-up questions. So in the first intake of the thing, we have the setting in the first approach and body what that is a solid. I think that the parents can hope to follow. In the next iteration, for the next assortment at the end of this year, we're thinking that the number will be rather funny. We want to scale up the program over the next 3 years to have an annual intake of 400. In the NGAP. And if we have an annual intake of 400 in the NGAP, so 400 in the first year, just say hypothetically all of them cost 400 in the second year, so 400 over 6 years in the program would give us 2,400 active participants in the NGAP program in any particular year once the program is running to stay. We estimate that this would, this is a complete revision in the past, we're going to say, would provide for 25%. Of the need for new academics in the system based on the time. It's an underestimation because our calculations have not looked at attrition through other ways, except through the retirements, through attrition and through expansion of the system. So the university is asked to put in applications for any applications, not simply to replace all posts, but to take this off in grant. So there would be a whole range of reasons for particular course. So for example, the university might be wanting to introduce a new area of specialization where there are no academics yet in that particular area of specialization. And again, that could be utilized as a vehicle to start getting cleaner people in this, understanding the obviously need of specialization or in older people, and there would be other mechanisms for recruiting those. I take Honorable Bazoli's point that this is not the complete solution. It certainly is. It certainly doesn't address the issue of the big numbers of older academics in professorial positions or actually in the major work in the university. And we have to look at other strategies in order to address that as we move forward. One of the possible strategies is possible longer retention of people in the system as we grow. Calls the young people to move upwards. If a person withdraws from the position we hold, certainly the funding will be there for that position, and that funding will move over into the next cycle of intake and will be taken up through or appointed through the next cycle. So it is an intention that we do replace people that fall out of the system. We hope to have a much better retention rate than is the case with other programs of this kind in the past. And that's because of the whole range of other activities that are supportive to the NGAP in their program. It's hard to estimate what the dropout rate would be. We're hoping for 80% retention rate, and we're certainly working hard to try and achieve this. We have to put in place, in
that we are already having projects with people, so that we have people who are committed to this program and actually support the new generation of academic speakers on the ground, understand the issues that they're facing, the problems, the challenges, and what to deal with them at the level before they become a problem that results in people dropping out of the service. So certainly we do want to have a much greater attention rate. One of the things that is going to be very important to have a monitoring organization based on this program, aligned to the program, so that as we implement the program, we start to learn from it and can improve it as we go along. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It does look like we've exhausted the discussion on this briefing. But then before we move over to the next briefing, I really would like to give my co-chair an opportunity to comment. Over to you, Honourable Member Matalia. If you've got issues or questions, this is your time to say. Alright. Thank you so much for the robust one to us. But what's good about it is it has helped us gain deeper insight into these matters. We need to know what's happening. So that if we support, we should know how to support. Thank you very much. We will now move on to the next briefing, which is a briefing by the National Research Foundation on funding of postgraduate in South African universities. Now, this one, I promise you without fail, I'm handing it over to my co-chair to run with it. Over to you, Honorable Chair.
No, thanks, Chair. Thanks very much, Chair, members of the committee, DG, for education and training, and DDG for science and technology. CEO of NRF. Without further ado, we will allow NRF to present the runway. DDG would like to make a comment before she comes in. Okay, over to you, NDC, the CEO.
And again, good morning, and honorable coaches, members, colleagues from the NTT and DFC. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I think we as NRF welcome the opportunity, especially to address the joint session. I think for us as NRF, it's the first time to be addressing the DHET parliamentary committee. And as you said, it's really good to have this information, background information about NRF in terms of what we actually do. We currently do have trilateral discussions, trilateral agreements, arrangements with DSP, NRF, and DHET. And so the conversations, as you heard in the previous presentation, have already begun. But this, I hope this presentation just tries to provide for you some background information and for you to then see areas of alignment, areas of possible collaboration going forward, areas of co-investment, or anything that's going to help us to address the kind of challenges that were raised in the previous presentation. If I have a look at the presentation, we're going to just give you very quickly an overview of the NRF, some contextual background to what we are going to talk about. Remembering that our brief was to talk very specifically to postgraduate funding within the NRF. We're going to look at support across the human capacity excellence development pipeline, the kinds of interventions for creating an enabling environment for research and postgraduate funding, as well as give you an indication on the broader NRF for the next 5 years going forward. As a reminder, in terms of contextualizing or looking at an overview of the NRF, I just want to highlight the 2 points from this particular slide, and it's as a reminder that NRF occupies a dual role within the national system of innovation. And when you think about this, it is, first of all, NRF as agency, which you are looking there at level 3. And in this particular space, we are interpreting and implementing public policy and strategy, and especially the grant-making role of the NRF resides within this agency function, where we support and promote research and engage in science, in broader science engagement. But if you look at level 4, NRF also sit as a research performer due to our national research facilities, which are high-end research platforms, which provide access to the university communities as well, to these platforms in astronomy, especially in nuclear sciences and biodiversity and environmental sciences. So this dual role is important for us to stress, because in some cases it's thought that it's just a grant-making role, but we do provide research platforms and therefore are research performers, much like some of the other agencies within the state. We have just come to an end of what we call Vision 2015, an end of 5-year strategic framework, and we're going into a new NRS Strategy 2020, and what we just want to highlight there, in line with this subject that we are discussing this morning, looking at systemic impact that can contribute to the growth of the national system of innovation. And if you have a look at those, you would see it speaks to numbers of doctoral students increase, numbers of I&I research outputs, increasing PhD graduates, and right down the line to the average annual increase in British values. Now this would be over a 5-year period and speaking to different parts of the system that collectively are going to contribute towards an active and productive research system that we have. The NRS, in line with research guidelines and in a way of working, is divided into 5 programs. Today our conversation around postgraduate research funding is going to focus chiefly on the work that is in Program 3. If you have a look there, Program 3 is Research and Innovation Support and Advancement, or what I will refer to by the acronym RISA. That is the chief grant-making part of the NRF, and the postgraduate support and funding would come chiefly out of that particular part of the NRF, and my colleague, Dr. Ganson Pillay, heads up that part of the NRF. And so when we speak, we are speaking mostly to the work out of RISA, notwithstanding that there are other divisions within the NRF as well. If we speak to funding, overall, if we have a look at the NRF funding, NRF has 3 primary core income streams. If you look, we start off right at the bottom with what is called a designated income. And that is income against a contractual agreement, which is entered into between the sponsor and the NRF. In our particular context, the contractual agreements are mainly with the Department of Science and Technology, but as was mentioned earlier, with DHET in terms of scarce skills, and currently still with the Department of Trade and Industry around the TRIP program. So that would be a large portion of our income stream around designated funding. We would then also have what is called the MPF Parliamentary Core Grant, which is that line there, and that would be our core grant coming to us out of the allocation. And then the one on top of that would be the ring-fence parliamentary grant. So in our allocation letter, we would find these particular ring-fence amounts of money that are allocated to specific programs, but part of our allocation letter. We have some availability of other income, mainly through interest or gain-taking, for example, or isotope sales, and that would give you a total income, as you see there, within the last year of just over 3 million rand, as you've seen. And so 3 billion. And so you can see these are our income streams, and we work according to those income streams in terms of the funding that becomes available to do the work that needs to be carried out in the NRF. Now going back to what I provided in the beginning and saying we'll focus on the research part of the NRF. And if you look at research sources of funding, you'll look at the research sources of funding from those 3 streams that I just explained to you right now. You would see the MPF core income, which as you can see over a period of time, we are looking at values from 2010-11 up to most recently 2014-15. The MPF core has been pretty stagnant in that
particular area, but the designated income increasing, MTF designated, and that income as well moving along. So RISA, in actual fact, receives 62% of the total NRF budget is lodged in the business and the activities of this particular part of the NRF, showing that over the five-year period of Vision 2015, we've invested about $3.18 billion in development in the science community, research and support development over that particular five-year period, most of it coming from the line items of Department of Science and Technology, and then with the other partners that I've mentioned. So that would be the funding situation that speaks very specifically to the grant-making part of the NRF. If you have a look at this particular slide that is before you, this would be for us RISA's contribution to the NMI being described by this diagram which we use and call the Human Capacity Development Excellence Pipeline. If you try and think back to the presentation that you have just heard and thought of, and look, think back to the framework slide that was there, there are in essence similarities to what is proposed and the way we think about this particular pipeline. Within an NRF context, we are saying this pipeline is actually indicative of our investment strategy as NRF in terms of research, support and development. So we are starting at one end, as you can see, we are talking about a broader base and going towards a kind of apex. And at that base, we are talking about what we are calling next generation researchers. Now, the next generation researchers for us would be largely your bursary support, which is masters and doctoral students that are supported. Well, let's start with the honors, and then masters and doctoral students will start to be supported to bursaries and fellowships. And these we identify as our next generation. These support, the support we are hoping would lead to these, especially honors and master's students, then following a, what we call a PhD track, and then moving into what we call emerging or early career research support. And in this phase, we are following development from a postdoc until the researchers develop a post-PhD track, and they develop what we are in NRF is calling a rating track, where they then achieve a rating and start to access funding as rated researchers within the research system. And these are early career research personnel within higher education or science campus. What we will also do is then look at the next one would be established researchers. These would then follow on into text, which now starts to talk about the senior researchers in terms of funding that becomes available for rated researchers and for competitive funding, and then also for blue sky research in terms of research that need that is done to think through problems that's not directly related to immediate ends right now. And right at the end, we have what we call our high-end strategic investment, where we have the very senior expertise in terms of research heading up South African research chairs or centers of excellence. You will see that the discipline base in the beginning is quite broad, but as you move up towards our strategic investments like our centers of excellence, you're going to have the discipline becomes very focused, and strategic focus at that end is very high in terms of the particular needs of both research and the country needs in alignment with what has been deemed strategic for development going forward. So if we look at that, we as NRF use this particular framework as a framework to guide our investments, to guide our program development, to guide the synergies. And we are looking for a balanced portfolio of investments across this particular pipeline and optimal synergies between, for example, the incoming parts of the pipeline, which is the students, the supervisory capacity that starts to talk to our established researchers, and then their contributions within strategic instruments like chairs and centers of excellence. So the challenge for us
is to actually ensure that we have a balanced portfolio of support and of investment across the entire pipeline to enable it to continue going forward. The national these investments that we are going to make according to that particular strategy, those investments would be framed according to national imperatives as well, and two key national imperatives behind the policy document that we use in considering the investment strategy but would be the National Development Plan 2030 and especially the HD targets that are a part of that particular plan. Some of them have been mentioned already and we would not go to all of them, but you can very clearly see that all of these in terms of ACG are clearly around the issues that were spoken about in the first presentation, the number of doctoral students, the doctoral graduates, how many additional PhDs we need to reduce. And in addition to speak about the fact that we need more than 50% of them, or most of them, need to be in the set science, engineering and technology. And trying to get to over 85% of university enrollment being postgraduates, currently sitting at 16%. So these are guiding targets in terms of investment strategies that we need to make in the pipeline, as well as what we have internally with the DST is what we call the Ministerial Director for Transformation Targets. And in 2013, Minister issued the guidelines for improving equity in the distribution of DST NRS bursaries and scholarships. And that is looking at issues of fundamental principles of representativity, of improved efficiencies, and priorities of state-related disciplines, using these targets to actually assist the DST to direct and coordinate the development of scarce skills. So you will see that the target for designated groups is at 8% for women, for black, 55% for women, and 4% for persons with disability. Also, we also the target speak to citizen distribution of students, where 87% of support would go to South African citizens and permanent residents, and then 5% for SADC, 4% for the rest of Africa, and 4% for out of Africa. And so I include these two broad directives at this stage so that as we go through the various slides and show you how the investments are panning out right now, that you would be mindful of the fact that we are directed in terms of reaching these particular transformation targets and the targets of the EDP in as far as possible. Within the NRS system, the types of support for postgraduate students, what we've just tried to do is outline for you what types of support becomes available from an honors level, master's, doctoral, and then extensions of master's or doctoral degrees. We have what are called freestanding competitive bursaries. Emphasis here is on a competitive system where students within universities apply for full-time studies in honors, master's, and doctoral degrees, or also part-time doctoral study support is also available. A second mode of support would be what we call grant-holding bursaries, where a professor applies for a research grant, and through that professor's research grant, she or he would be able to support students, and those are called grant-holding bursaries, and all of those would be for full-time studies attached to that particular research product, and master's or doctoral level also part-time studies. And then block grants that are available given to universities to provide support for honors and master's study. The graph at the bottom gives an indication of the levels between, percentage levels between full-time and part-time studies, and you will see there that most of the NRS supported bursaries are for full-time studies in each of the years. Last year talking to 94% full-time and 6% part-time in terms of the postgraduate support. If we look at the pipeline investment, now remember when I'm talking about pipeline, I'm talking to that pipeline that we show you on the slide. If you have a look at it,
It went from the next generation, which was student support, right to the top end of that, apex of that particular pipeline, which was a strategic investment. And you will see that at least 36% of the funding is at the next generation. It's building capacity, ensuring we get pipeline funding for students into that particular sector of the pipeline, the next generation. And then the other high investment is in the strategic investment, the strategic instrument that we have. Researchers will complain to us about the funding that we are giving to established researchers, because that seemed to be the supervisory capacity that you were speaking to earlier in your questions and discussion. And as I said to you, the challenge for us is to find the balance of investment across the portfolios that exist in that particular pipeline. If you look at the postgraduate investment, what we're showing you here is the blue line representing investment. As you can see, both DST and DHET are making investments into this area. And any in what we all need and what has been put on the table before that is an increase in these investments. But these graphs show you the investments that are currently being made in the pipeline in terms of honors, masters, doctoral, and postdoctoral investments currently. And we're going to see that if we're going to change this, we're going to have to increase the levels, increase investment at the honors, but we're also going to have to address dropout rates and the attrition rates that we have along this particular pipeline if we're going to find that investments we make at honors level gives us the kind of graduations that we need back out at a doctoral and postdoctoral investment levels. And so we need to probably change these investment patterns and then introduce the other support initiatives that were spoken about this morning within the higher education systems themselves to address the matter of the high dropout rates along this particular pipeline. If we look at DHET partnership with NRF in terms of what's called the Skills Development Fund, we have a look, they have made a significant investment in terms of scholarships and fellowships, and this slide gives you an indication of the total financial investment. The smaller red blocks talk to CIGA total investment, CIGA being the Institute of Chartered Accountants. There was a partnership with them as well, where accounting was seen as a skill and a vulnerable discipline, and they wanted to build capacity in that particular field of accounting, and a partnership was in place between NRF and CIGA as well. And this is looking at partnerships and how partnerships can add to the investment capacity. One thing we may say about NRF in terms of partnerships, we're an organization that is scalable, so we do have the systems in place, and additional investments do not mean we have to make additional structural arrangements, but actually additional, we can take up additional investments at short notice. If you look at that, what we showed you were the investments, and if you look at now the DHET partnership with NRS funding students from an honors VTech, master's, doctoral, and postdoctoral, and having a look at the total for the last year at just under 2,000 students across that particular pipeline of investment from honors to postdoctoral. So you can see the larger numbers being funded at honors, and if you look at the attrition as we go down from honors to master's to doctoral and then to postdoctoral, and so we need to continue to be mindful of that pattern that emerges. In this particular partnership, currently as it stands, you'll find overall this funding is 65% black and 55% female. And so we'll have a way to go to reach the 80% black target that has been set in terms of this skills partnership. If we look at the proportion of NRF funded students to total registrations per study level, so this is looking at the number of students that NRF funds in proportion to the total number that are registered at university, you can see within these areas that we are funding, if I just take the last year,
at least 5% of honor students, 7% of master students, and 14% of doctoral students, on average across the pipeline for an honors and doctoral, between 8 to 10% of the total registration. So you can see from an NRF perspective, our impact on the system, even given the money that we, or the funding that we have shown you, is at least 10% of the students. And we'd have to be seeing that the investment would need to be increased if we're going to impact beyond that particular funding. If you can look even without investment of funding, I think what we're saying is that the growth, we went from 1.5% in 2006 of honors to 5% in 2013. 12% in 2006 of 12.18% doctoral students to 14.12% doctoral students over that particular year. So recognizing that we are funding a smaller percentage of the total system, but also recognizing that the progression over those numbers of years would seriously need to be ramped up as well. In terms of transformation demographics, student demographics, remember I showed you the target that I said that I said working with 80% black and 55% women in this case. If we have a look at them, except for honors in both black and women, in most of the areas, as we've shown, the direct numbers are shown here, but in most of them, we have not reached the transformation target at that level as yet. It's still significant work being undertaken with the universities in order to try and reach those targets. But as we said, the targets are being reached currently in the honors level, but not yet at master's and doctoral or postdoctoral level. The kind of things that are in place right now is to look at the rates and doing the targets in our calls to universities, so universities are mindful of these and their applications to the NRF start to look at rates and gender targets in the university system itself from an application phase. There's a broader conversation with the universities so that they are aware of these targets and our need to reach them and working with us to actually achieve these targets. And providing directed support of the kind that you discussed earlier, especially in institutions where the research or post graduate office is not well positioned to provide students with that kind of support. So in terms of transformation demographics, we do, as I showed you earlier, we are seeing increases every year, but we are working towards that particular overall target. Students with disabilities, the numbers here are still fairly low, but we also recognize as NRS that we have not been capturing the data on persons with disabilities in a way that gives us the kind of data. We suspect the numbers might be higher than what we have here, but we're actually engaging with universities to understand the specific needs of persons with disabilities and understanding and developing a directed support in terms of increasing and attaining our 4% level that we need to be supporting with students with disabilities. If you look at the annual NRF funded graduations that are taking place, again you would have a look also in terms of looking at across the pipeline from the honors and the doctoral and the drop-off from the honors level. If we just take the last year that's shown there, 2013, 2,762 honors graduates, so they graduated. Masters, the level is down to 1,435, and then doctoral down to 459. And I think generally the conversation that we have as a system must take this into account. And so this is actual graduations as opposed to just registration. Part of what we're looking to do is also then to see from a graduation point is to track to see what happens to these students once they have graduated and where they will be taken up into the system. But we'll speak about that further on. This slide talks to the percentage of DSP NRF supported masters and doctoral students that are graduating, as well as the graduation information that we are getting from the HEMIS data, so HEMIS percentage graduation. So if you have a look at it, look at Masters, MS and NRF, and then looking at percentage of supported students that are graduating. And you're finding that the data is showing us that the percentages of students that are graduating from the NRF funded bursaries tend to be higher in many instances. We're thinking that this could be speaking to the competitive process that is put in place in terms of application from the universities, the robust grant making that is taking place. So this is looking at the talking to issues around throughput and getting the system, the students through the system in terms of focus on graduation, linked as well to the time, PhD time to completion, where we're finding we have the national average, which comes from the PhD study undertaken by ASA, and then the NRF average years to completion, which we have seen up until 2007, and it showed us it's lower than the national average. We don't have that to pass the ASA study, but this is what we've seen, a slight decrease, and then an increase again in the last years around it. And this is something we're investigating as well as in time to completion, what might be causing those discrepancies. So that speaks very specifically to numbers, to quantitative data, financial investment and numbers around the postgraduate support provided through the NRF. I want to just move on to look at some of the programs which provide an enabling environment to assist university sector assists the graduates to actually move on in terms of their degrees. And one of these would be a sabbatical grant for university academic staff. And you see these kinds of grants are all of them really to improve the qualifications of academics and to enhance their research and their supervisory capacity in terms of the kinds of initiatives that were talked about earlier. We have a special program called the Tutuka program, and the Tutuka program, especially for academic staff, the Tutuka program is a partnership program and implemented in collaboration with the public universities. It's funded by the NRF through the core grant and the contract funding, and it's especially looking to opportunities for redress and access to research funding opportunities, and it is a development track in terms of moving from the PhD, the postdoc, and the writing track. So a successful participant within the Tutuka program could eventually actually qualify for 9 years of funding in terms of their career development and give some form of consistency and support towards becoming an established researcher. This is one of the programs that we as well need to grow both participation and funding in terms of Tutuka and grow success in support of higher education. If you remember, at the tip of that strategic pipeline were our strategic investments, the, especially the research chairs and the centers of excellence here, where you have your high-end researchers, you have high output, and these also include, especially in SAGI, they can be headed up by quality researchers from outside South Africa, and this is where we're finding we are having a mix of both local, national, and international expertise providing input into our research system. If we look at the student support, and this just speaks to earlier the nationality in terms of those targets, if you remember, and you'll see just under the research chairs is really pleasing research support in terms of the research chairs themselves, and you can see from that particular table that is shown that most of the support is for South African and permanent residents, but also that we have support for SADC, other African countries, and international students within the SAGI research chair initiative. Don't worry about the small print, but if you have a look at that, that's our centers of excellence. You can see that the there's an increase in the number of doctoral graduations. These doctoral students are trained within these high-end instruments, centers of excellence. The postdoctoral research fellow now is increasing as well. And the number of peer-reviewed publications. So investment in these high-end instruments means that students trained, they are benefiting as well from that expertise, and we're finding that the graduations are proceeding within the required time. We also, under NRF, would manage the square kilometre array, and chief to the square kilometre, the investments in the square kilometre array is the development of the capacity and the skill that is going to be needed going into the future in the management of SK1 and development post that. And if we have a look, we've just provided thumbnail statistics to look at the training that has been provided, postgraduate training that has been provided through the SKA project currently, and you'll see from there we have bursary support at doctoral and master's values. We have the doctoral support that's been provided, and if you look at the, we have support provided, but I'm sure very quickly you'll be able to point out that we have 74% male and 26% female within the astronomy environment, and it's something that they are working towards. We can have a look at it also within the South African situation in terms of male and female and race. So race and gender are issues that we will continue to address, but this is a skills high-end area, and efforts are being made through the multi-layered strategy to address these statistics. Internationalization is for us a catalyst for postgraduate growth, and we use our international agreements, our inter-agency agreements, and our multilateral science and technology agreements to continue to catalyze for more and more postgraduate growth and the experience that is gained through this particular in-country and training abroad. We do have what is the DARD in-country scholarships for South Africa that is just over 1,000 students in the last application there. The partnerships with TWASC and the scholarships that are working for and this is using support for students on the African continent. We then have a special partnership with the Freya University in Amsterdam. There we have the South African Desmond Tutu doctoral scholarship program, Fulbright, Commonwealth Universities, and then the use of international infrastructure for the training of our students, JINR, the Joint Institute for Nuclear Research in Russia, and CERN in Europe, and both of those become tackles where our students gain access, as do our researchers, ensuring that our training of the highest quality in those particular fields as well. We don't just highlight, we have a what is called DST NRF internship program, and this DST internship, NRF internship program is a program that takes up the flag of unemployed graduates, and these unemployed graduates are given opportunities for both work experience and research experience and in conjunction with CEREMA research management experience. So they can be employed for up to a year in an environment to gain some experience just out of university. And then if you look at it, many of them become employed on completion of their internship, and then others go on to complete their studies. So honors graduates may go on to take up a master's, masters may go on to take up a PhD. And we think this is a really, really useful program for unemployed graduates to offer them that experience for further employability and also to think carefully and gain experience that help them to make a decision around continuing with their particular studies. And you find the fact that many of them are employed on completion of the internship is very promising. There are a number of studies because of the situation and the challenges that face us. We need, as we said, the evidence base in terms of the way forward in many of these. What's causing the problems that we find? What can we do? What new programs would need to be constructed, would need to be conceptualized to address these challenges at institutional level, at national levels. And the DST and some of the studies in collaboration with university partners, the DST mentioned a study of the postgraduate study pipeline. and that brings to the fore a number of the issues that were raised here this morning. You can see this study was done in conjunction with South African universities, and it explains the methodology there, web-based electronic survey, in terms of looking at issues that surround the postgraduate study pipeline. We've just highlighted one or two things, and this question of part-time studies and full-time studies, and the question was what percentage of students are currently employed while enrolled for a degree. And if you look there in terms of honors degrees and masters and doctoral degrees, that the higher percentage of students are working while studying, and we know that that in itself can then lead to time to completion and all of the challenges that we spoke about. So that the evidence base for that is provided. In terms of where are they employed while they are enrolled for the degrees, where are they working, are they new institutions, our institutions, this gives you an indication. Doctoral students, you can see there, most of them are in the university setup, and that is good in terms of the suggestions to provide their time within the setup to complete those doctoral degrees, master's degrees as well, whereas in honors you find that they are largely in industry or private sector and then studied while working in those particular areas. So the kinds of programs we need to think about can be informed by the evidence that is attached for us that has been received. Discontinuing the dropout rate, things that you spoke about, what percentage of students considered discontinuing the studies, and the frightening thing is that the higher percentage, they did not want to continue their studies. And so I guess the first thing you're asking, so why? Why would they not want to continue their studies at any stage within the program? And the top three, there were various reasons, but the top three reasons given by degree level. And it's interesting that they are aggregated out at degree level, because you can see that the reasons are given across the degree levels change, but you can also understand that that is related to the stage of life at different stages of each degree level. If we look at the doctoral, as we understand, our doctoral students are generally much older. They would be having families at that particular time and financial commitments. So at that level, the financial challenges become very acute in terms of their decision to continue or discontinue their studies. As honors, part of the conversation this morning spoke to the chief reason, the top three reasons, one of the top three reasons, is that the challenge to cope with the student and the study demands. So that speaks to both the university support that's provided and the quality of readings for university life, as it were. So these are, you can see quite clearly, with impact on throughput rates and therefore impact on how we funnel our investments and the kind of support that we need to provide at different levels. Another intervention that is in progress right now is a study to track, it's called a DSC tracking study, to find out these postgraduate students that have been funded over time, where do they go to, where do they land up, where do they work, what contributions are they making in the system post their graduation and post their funding. And so with DSC, NRF is looking at a long-term tracking project of DSC NRF fund graduates and looking at how we can track them throughout the system and what needs to be in place. This is not as easy as it seems, because we know once the students leave the university system, finding them and finding out where they have landed up becomes quite a, well, let's say an almost impossible task. What we have found, one thing that remains consistent would be their ID numbers, for example, and so tracking them now has got us into a conversation with staff, and that would be a different conversation to have. So we're looking quite extensively and in-depth in terms of how to, because this is the real information that would make a difference, that talks to what difference has the funding made in terms of economic development on the system as a whole. Over the next 5 years, this is not only specific to co-graduate support, but will touch very specifically on it. We are needing to scale up the R&D enterprise funding. I think we've heard that over and over again, the importance of the funding that is needed, and that's the primary roadmap for us to actually drive those targets I show you. The South African Research Infrastructure Roadmap developed by the DSE, and we're going to use that to wrap up student intake at a level commensurate with the band in that particular roadmap. Guided by the Strategy for Human Capital Development for Research, Innovation and Scholarships, looking at the creation of high-end instruments, possibly national research institutes, because we've seen that these high-end instruments do provide a leverage in terms of research, the system, the publication rate, the impact, and obviously the students that come out of there. Site engagement also as a driver to attract young adults to university careers, and that is important in terms of getting them from the school system into the university system, maths and science within school system, as enablers to drive them to think about these careers, and then international collaboration and partnership with a focus on intensifying and strengthening the Africa partnerships and obviously continuously expand global networks and through these to increase and achieve graduation numbers that we have been talking about. So these are the interventions within the NRF and what is currently taking place in terms of postgraduate student support through the NRF. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Acting CEO. Clearly, this reinforces what the department presented here on higher education, and you see the need for collaboration and working together to deal with the challenges ahead of us. We'll take this opportunity to allow us to ask questions on the presentation. I'll ask the chair to take the questions so that I don't think you speak there to avoid that because he knows you better by name. Over to you, chair.
I think it is only fair. All right, thank you very much. I will now call upon Professor Mozoli, Honorable Member Kuno, Honorable Member Mkagine, in that order.
Thank you very much. It's always inspiring to see the NRF and what they're doing with the very little money that they get. Now, one of the things that struck me was the excellent Tatuka scheme that the NRF has been running for many years is not dissimilar to the new academic scheme that the department is launching. So I'm just wondering whether the two, could I suggest that the two departments actually have formal discussions so that the Department of Higher Education and Training is able to gain insight from some of the failures and some of the successes in the Tatuka scheme so they are not repeated in the EGAP, what's it called? NGAP scheme. There's a lot of wisdom in the NRF about these young academics and their upkeep. And also, they may well be able to give insight into the rate of attrition in a scheme like this, which is actually higher than I think perhaps the VHET is predicting.
Thank you, Professor Bozoli, Honorable Member Kulu.
Thank you, Chair. Let me thank NRF for the presentation. I think the only issue that you're working with is complementing what is being done in the CBH. I would like to know what is the benefit of NRF in partnership with government departments. And do you receive money from the government department? If NRF receives this money, do the department subscribe as to what programs or qualifications should that money be used for? If yes, how does this impact on the objectives of the target of NRF? I was also looking at slide 18, which speaks to the partnership trends with disabilities. One for all grads. It shows that if you're looking at those components, they have decreased by 50%, but it did explain that it might not be proper actual numbers because much was not done. One would then advise us to
little bit more information with regards to death, that because then makes us be looked in a negative way, that we're not really taking this categorically if we're not kind of required. We want to make ensure that we want more, to make more contributions with regards to the people with disabilities as well. On slide 17, where there is race and gender targets, the part which says men and women. I wanted to ask if when you say black, do you differentiate between Africans and black South Africans? Because that's the problem. We have this broad category which says black, but if you go deep into as to what is comprising of these black people, it will be your African and your black South African. I just want to know if you do take note of that when you are making your projections.
Well, so far these are the three hands that came up of Ms. Killian.
Chairperson, if you just come on my side, thank you for the presentation. I was just wondering, if we look at slide 13.
Can you just raise your voice?
If we look at slide 14, Jane, the issue for Charleston Council, that is also available in this program. Is there not perhaps a possibility of other similar arrangements, fellowships, or do they exist? I'm just thinking of, you know, engineering and all the other sorts of disciplines. If that could perhaps be expanded to also benefit from funding from those institutions. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the question. I will now hand over to, I don't know whether it will be the CEO, the acting CEO, to provide responses.
Thank you. I think Professor Lizio's comment is noted that there is a trilateral in the departments of DNT, DHEP, and NRS do have conversations. I know there were specific conversations around the NGAP, but should there be further need specifically around TUCA, that, you know, we can ensure that it happens as well. I think you see the alignment across a range of instruments, and Professor Yale did indicate this morning that there would be also conversations around research components, you know, shared partnerships where possible. I think it's just identifying where that is actually possible. Ultimately, a question of NRF in partnership with government departments. So our main government department is the DFP, but as I said, we have the scarce skills partnership, funding partnership with the DHET, which is a specific funding partnership. We also have a partnership with the Department of Trade and Industry, and we have for many years have run a technology for human resources and industry program. There are a number of other departments, Department of Labor, for example, we run a innovation virtue program on their behalf as well. So we do have partnerships with other departments, and it would be exactly as you said, that they would fund a specific program that they have in mind, and that program would obviously have certain deliverables, but we make sure that when we enter into those kind of agreements, that the deliverables are in line with our mandate. So you can see in this particular case, the partnership with DHET would be around postgraduate funding, which is our core mandate, and so there would not be any strain from our objective of making sure that we are headed in the same direction. So key to partnerships would be our mandate, what is our core mandate, and any partnership we enter into would be making sure we remain true to that mandate in terms of research, support, and development. So the answer is yes, we do have partnerships. We're looking to increase those partnerships, but it must be around the core mandate. So you would find they are usually in student support, largely in student support, but others supporting of researchers and research programs themselves, which is the work that we do.
Thank you very much.
Co-Chair, Honourable Members, for the privilege of DLR representing. I thought it was a very important platform. And if we got the quality portfolio committee to capitalize.
Regarding the street car, yes, Mr. Bazzoli, those discussions have been ongoing. We see that as a partnership with the higher education and training in terms of expanding those numbers. There's also discussion with another funding instrument, what we call the professional development program. But the thinking behind this in terms of expansion is if DHE can take care of getting the academics to graduation, then the investment from the MRF will be more in the research and development arena, which would then allow both of us to win, to be able to expand the numbers. The lessons learned, I must say that there is study co-chairs that we commissioned last year with Dr. Linda Field regarding the socio-economic return on investments of some of our select instruments. One of those instruments was Stuka, so it would be good to share the data with the DHET in terms of information dissemination, but also lessons learned and the positioning of Stuka into the future. Honourable Edmund Kulu, you want to know about the arts for government department. My colleagues after the month after that degree, but I'd just like to remind ourselves that there was a ministerial review that suggested there should be a unitary science vote. So irrespective of which department you are in the country, all monies for R&D should accrue into one ministry or one department with accountability to the contributing ministries and the report to the contributing ministries. That is a conversation we hope that will come to fruition, because that will assist us hugely in amalgamating the resources and focusing and targeting more strategically into the future in terms of meeting the requirements. Regarding prescriptions, then we'll be trying to have a partnership agreement, not with a prescriptive one, whereby it's complementary rather than prescriptive. We have our strategic plan, of course, it's aligned there. The final issue referred to that the issue with disabilities, just like to inform you that we've now incorporated into our data system students with disabilities. We're also trying to mine data that we didn't capture previously and are cross-checking this with the universities. Slide 17, race and gender targets. Black, in terms of another definition, refers to all persons are not white, okay, which includes colored Indians and Africans. However, for our purposes internally, in terms of making an accurate assessment, the black is broken down into the various race groups, for us to have a better handle on how our investments are going. Regarding FICA and other arrangements, it's also important that we have conversations. We have conversations with the Transport Stock Exchange. We have a partnership with the Bravo Foundation, scholarships in engineering. And so there are a number of small partners that we are having conversations with, largely to leverage funding. Because we are a 3A entity, we're not going to a profit-making or fundraising mode, but to use leverage as a potential. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much, Honourable Co-Chairs, for the opportunity to just add a few words and also for the questions that the Honourable Members have asked. Thank you for organising this joint meeting. It's the first time I had the opportunity to attend the joint meeting of two committees, and it's been very gratifying and rewarding to be exposed to this excellent Committee on Higher Education and Training. And I'm certain that there's a lot of things in common that will pull these committees together as they move ahead. The colleagues from the NRF have presented to you a very comprehensive overview of the program that they have to support postgrad students. In the context of this being a joint meeting of the two higher education and training and the science technology committees, and in the context of parliamentarians focusing also at policy level issues, I thought perhaps to just extract five high-level take-home messages from the presentation from the National Research Foundation, perhaps just to leave them with the honourable members. First is starting off with an observation that the South African outputs of postgraduate students and of research and the impact of that research has increased very significantly. significantly over the last 10 years. In one of the early slides from Dr. Mond, some of the statistics were indicated. I think postgrad PhD production increased by 43%. Research output, she indicated 33%. In fact, over 10 years, it's improved by 100%. There's been significant increases in productivity of the higher education system. Those increases have been much higher than the increases in the size and therefore the capacity of the higher education system. And so therefore, this is a course for jubilation, but it is also something that we need to take account of, because those increases in productivity are not sustainable unless the size of the system starts growing as well, and that's really what we're working on very closely together between the two departments. So that's the first take-home message. The second one I wanted to leave with you is that there is a drop-off in the representativity of the demographics of our student components as we go from undergraduate to honors to masters and to PhD. Again, this is something that we have observed jointly in the two departments and that we're working on closely, and that's background to the ministerial guidelines that the MRF is working towards. So that at the postgraduate level, the demographics are also driven strategically and aggressively by the two departments working together. Now, the reasons for this demographic drop-off, why are there proportionately fewer black students in postgrad and fewer women students at the postgrad level, particularly at the PhD level? The reasons for this are complex. They're as complex as the reasons why people choose an academic career or choose not to pursue an academic career. So the reasons for students staying on from an undergraduate to a postgrad degree are complex. The NRS slides presented some of those considerations to you, but we are working closely with experts in the sector and with our colleagues in the DHET to understand those reasons and to develop policy responses to them. We think we do understand them now. Finance is clearly a consideration, but it is not the only one, and it doesn't even account for 50 or 60% of the variance. It accounts for only about 30% of the variance. So there are three or four other important considerations, including things having to do with the final circumstances of our students that determine whether they are able to pursue postgrad studies or not. But we think we have a good understanding of this complex problem now, and are now in a position to develop policy response to those. On the question of financial support, this was raised by several of the honourable members. I think it's important perhaps to just point out that NISTAS supports around 22-23% of undergraduate students, something like that, just sort of a quarter. That's the support of NISTAS. In other words, that's the level of public level support for undergraduate students. The NRF program for postgrads is the single biggest source of support for postgrads. It's not the only one. The DHET also has some funds for postgrad students and some other government departments. But as a single program, the NRF postgrad student support program is the biggest one at $620 million this year. And that only supports just under 10% of postgrad students. And this is a major constraint in the system, that you're dropping from about just under a quarter of students at the undergraduate support, at the undergraduate level being supported by public funds, to around about 10% at the postgrad level. So it's a big bottleneck in the system, and we have engaged closely with Treasury on this. And Treasury's been very receptive, and indeed this year we got 400 million rand of new money for postgrad support. We believe as a consequence of Treasury recognizing this constraint in the system. So I thought it important perhaps to highlight that bottleneck and the fact that we have actually a very small footprint in the postgraduate system. We jointly support 10, 11, 12% at most of the postgrad students. So the ability of the state to drive the characteristics of the postgrad cohort is limited, because we have very little direct footprint on it. And then the last point that I wanted to perhaps leave you with is that I think we're making significant progress jointly in our work and individually in identifying challenges and beginning to formulate responses to them, the increase in the productivity, which I mentioned earlier on, that the universities have achieved, I think is evidence of very successful interventions by government in the university system. We still have a long way to go, but I think the prospects for success are improving every day as we work together more and more closely and as we understand the challenges better and better, and are therefore able to develop the policy responses such as the NGAP program, which our colleagues in the Department of Higher Education and Training have developed. Thank you very much.
I don't know how this is just a follow-up question by Ms. Kalimi, a professor, and a follow-up question.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thanks for the presentation. On slide number 9, the NRL has set its PhD target, which are in line with the National Development Plan. And this target talks to the increase of the percentage of the staff with PhDs from 43% to 75%. And also producing 100 doctoral graduates per million by 2030. Now my question is, what challenges has NRL identified as cause of students not to achieve this PhD? How will the NRF solve this challenge? And does the NRF believe that with the current funding growth and patents to the institute, NDP targets will be achieved? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My question is linked to that one of Aramuk coming. It's about searching now the value for money. With regard to the production of PhDs from 43% to 75%, so that they contribute to the development agenda for the country. You know, how to check that they really contribute, specifically with regard to knowledge creation, so and economic development of the country. School producing, the movie was producing 75%. How do you check that they fail for money? The second one, Chairperson, I don't know whether it was asked in my agenda. What are the selection criteria that are followed, for instance, for grant holder linked persons? So, because those are linked to a particular academic. The criteria that are used so that you are in that particular academic is also selected. A certain cohort of students. And then how many did you fund in 2014, 2015 year? So thank you very much, Chairperson. Those are my questions.
Next, Honorable Member
here. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'd like to touch on what the DG technology technology refers to, and that is the issue of the difficulty that these students, especially from poor black families, have to continue to further their studies. What is often reported in some articles is what is termed the black tax. I mean, people, when they enter a career, they actually have to help some of the siblings that their studies are better, okay, so which makes it increasingly difficult. So if comments about the difficulty that some of these students have to in fact further their studies beyond postgraduate, is that based on any research that was conducted? And if you could just give us more information about that, or is it just a general comment that he has made? And then the second matter that I would like to know is if you it appears that your funding has so far had excellent results in terms of turning out graduates within a very short period, within academic years. it was far below the national average. Why is it? Is it and pull factors? It's because students realize that they lose out if they fail. What sort of lies within the motivation of those students, if you could tell us about that?
Thank you very much. Honourable Member Kim.
Just one question for you, firstly. I would like to know how many of the Christians are in this local disadvantaged university.
Well, mine would be to ask NRF to clarify the TRIP funding, whether it will continue to be administered by NRF, or it will now, moving forward, maybe the next financial year, administered by the Department of Trade and Industry. Maybe if you could share with us on what informed the move.
Honourable co-chairs and honourable members, thank you very much for this question. Honourable member, you, at the time you are here, have some information, I'll repeat it for the purpose, for your purposes. The cutting, the slight that PhD harder, you know, one of the challenges. I think what we need to appreciate here is that the NRF has transitioned from the NRF Vision 2015 to a new strategy called NRF 2020. It's important for me to point out that the NRF strategy is aligned to the GSC strategy. Okay? And the GSC and NRF strategy also seeks alignment with the National Development Plan. So what you see on this other slide here is essentially those targets that resonate with the mandate of the NRF and the GSC. So while these are National Development Plan targets, we attempt to plan out of a little greater, like a stretch target. In terms of academic start of PhD, we produced a document called Scaling Up the South African Research Enterprise. And as the Deputy CEO pointed out in the presentation, it's a very scalable model. The evidence for that scalability comes through when you look at the peak in doctoral students in 2011, when the Minister, through a special director, provided additional funding for human capital development. So the system is hungry and crying. The resources are what's impacting negatively on moving the system forward. So it's resource-driven. Regarding tracking the tracking study and the value for money, as I indicated, we commissioned the study on the social economic return investments on five selected economic instruments. So the South African Research Initiative, the Centers of Excellence Program, the Tutuka Program, the National Equipment Program, and the postgraduate bursaries. What we defined is that because we have data, we are now able to gather baseline data that shows that those investments have positive impact socioeconomically. The take-home lesson from that was that in order for us to build plans, you have to plan for impact at the beginning of intervention, because these are longitudinal studies. And therefore, planning at the beginning is absolutely critical in going forward. So your question as to how we know what the contribution of these academics we should make in the PhD is something that we have to plan for at the beginning so that we are able to track it. The one point that I'd like to emphasize, which the DC has also referred to, if we do not form a partnership with the South African Visual Services, all our tracking studies become zero, because that is the only reliable system within the country that's able to tell us where someone is at a particular stage in their life through their tax returns. So I think with DHET and the TSC, the PBC, trying to capitalize on partnership is very important for us to get the tax study going. The question was about selection criteria. I'm pleased to inform you that the NRF has a very robust and transparent grant-making system. Every funding instrument is clearly advertised. All funding criteria are there. There is a scoring model, a scoring methodology. The reviewers are selected both nationally and internationally. Adjudication panels are absolutely independent. The NRF is a resource person and does not adjudicate those applications. So, any applicant, whether it's a student or a researcher, know full well before they even start to apply what the rules of the engagement are. So it's very careful of that. Regarding how many of the grant holder bursaries were given this year, Unfortunately, I can't give that information offhand, but I'll be happy to provide that to you post-season. Regarding birth leave and the short period you referred to, yes, we did find that there was a decrease in the period taken for students. That's largely because of the selection criteria used. The challenge that we have, and the DDG referred to it as well, is the leaky pipeline, whereby the tenure of students is something that we are grappling with. This is largely because if you're the first child in your home, and you're a graduate, there's expectation for you to put on the table. And so you're conflicted between continuing studies or earning some money to be able to take care of family. What we have done incrementally is funny enough. The DSCA has requested that we increase, the minister, increase the number of bursaries, but also increase the value of bursaries. And we have evidence to show that we've increased the number and an increase the value, unfortunately, through money. I want to, I'm delighted that you asked the question about PRIP. But I'm going to hand over to Dr. DeMoss to respond.
Over to you.
Thank you, Coach. The SIMP has been with the NRF for over 20 years. I think it's a really successful university-industry partnership. The Department of Trade and Industry took a decision. Well, first of all, they instituted a study at least 2 years ago to look at the possibilities of rethinking, so in line with the DTI, a revised DTI mandate. And last year took a decision that the program will be implemented out of the DTI. They were looking at consolidating all their programs, SPY, as well as SRIP and any of the other programs that were outside of the DTI. So as of 1st April 2015, the program is in the DTI, but we are managing the current cohort of researchers which have were issued grants in 2015, and so they would have two outlying years. So we are currently managing that. The Director General has informed us that they will not continue the, in its current format. So TRIP as a current instance, that they will revise a format in line with a renewed mandate within DTI. That is the latest that we have right now.
Well, thank you very much. And Honourable Member Kitan, your hand came a little bit late, but we can still teach you.
Yeah, sorry, Jack. Our secretary hesitated to ask this question because I've asked so many a time, that the research that is done, maybe next time when you come, if you could show us how it translates directly. I'm asking this because in other countries you hear this research that is groundbreaking, it has changed the whole industry of producing these things. And today these things are particularly in commodity is produced cheaper, and that has created factories all over the world, and it is creating jobs for the people of that country. This is what I'm really feeling concerned that people could get these PhDs, very brilliant people showing how, or are the institutions that, because this can't deliver it, you've got to design it, such that whatever we do academically ultimately translate directly into the society. You know when Chris Barnard did the heart transplant, we were all proud that it was the first in the world. When the Stellenbosch people did the latest one in medicine. So you hear about medicine, but what about industry where the competition is? Because that is where we're going to face the world, and that is what is going to determine whether we create jobs for our people, industries. I know with mining they say we South Africa, because of its research, is able to dig the deepest mines in the world. Maybe it has been overtaken by Argentina, but it is one of the top. But that is raw material. In the supply value chain, you'd like to see South Africa in manufacturing, not just repairing other people's things, but initiating things casually like that can sell cheaper and still be durable.
So I'm just saying, next time when you do that, if you could just ask the direct link and the direct design of how we go to face the world and create life, ultimately it's about livelihood for our own people out of this brilliant place. That's
we are covered. All right. Thank you very much. These questions keep popping up, popping up, popping up. What is the question? Okay. The question was not responded to me. Can you repeat the question?
My apologies. If you want to know the most positive HDI. Okay, let me make a generic statement. There are more thought shares that HAI has ever been than HDI. We've recognized that in the previous slide. We've addressed this in the new round of the new announcement. It's still not enough. The exact figure I can provide to you, I don't want to give you inaccurate figures because the meeting recorded and I would not like to give you misinformation.
So
you
should do make a comment that the honourable member, I think it's we're talking about postgraduate students, but I take your comment about trying to link it to actual changes either in the economy or the quality of life and the stories about it. We realize in the system that we've not adequately told those stories because there are examples of where the scientific and technological developments have actually made a difference, but we will make sure that these come to you. I just want to maybe highlight one that I experienced 2 weeks ago. We went to the Central University of Technology in Bloemfontein, where we launched a new chair at the Central University of Technology as in additive manufacturing, using the 3D technology and using titanium as the raw material for that particular technology. In this case, still linked to the health system. In front of us sitting were 2 patients. They had benefited from that specific technology and its application through titanium, that they had both suffered from cancer and their jaws had been reconstructed, and the technology, they used the technology that had been developed at CUT by the professors there, and the actual titanium jaws were developed in the lab at Central University of Technology. And then in conjunction with the surgeon, this jaw transplant took place, and these 2 patients who would have otherwise not been socially acceptable because of the degeneration of the jaw, sat there totally socially acceptable and told of the impact of the on the quality of life that has changed because of the manufacturing process and the high technology development that took place on that particular campus. So for me, that is one of the things, and I know those are the kind of stories we need to tell more often and bring here, just to assure you that it is going on, and we will find a way to bring all of those stories to you. Thank you.
We have various stories on this. I mean, case of all UCC, a Joseph vaccine malaria, and then going to the future, that will be an $80 billion saving on just human life. But I think the point is well taken about providing examples. Coach, quietly, I just want to make a few points before we leave. Let's respond further to Sachi. I think what was important in the NRF was not about the institution that hosts the Sachi chair, but whether we're supporting black people and whether we're supporting women. Okay? The response to that indicates the minister that the percentage of women is too low amongst the chairs. So the minister requested that we make a dedicated call for 20 research chairs for women. That call has gone out, you've received application, adjudication has been made, and I urge you to watch Morning Live on the 2nd of September, where the minister will make a formal announcement of this intervention. So he gave you one of the chairs for it. The second point I want to make is that at the PPC for Science and Technology, we indicated to the PPC that the United budget or the ESC budget is actually less than the NISPA's budget. And if you think what you have achieved within that budget is less than NISPA's, it is quite a challenge. There was also an expression indicating that South Africa had moved from a 1 cent investment on R&D to 1.5%. Our plea to you is that please join forces with the GSTBC in trying to push this agenda so that we get that investment of 1.5 so we can scale up the model and achieve the targets we want to achieve. Thank you.
I don't want our presenters to go away misunderstanding. It isn't just in a very simplistic way about stories. So if you come this time, then you've got a list of 100 stories. No, what I'm asking for is, if you can show, I don't know how you measure it, but if you can show how all this research that you're doing ultimately fundamentally changes life in terms of jobs in the community, in terms of competing with the world, in terms of addressing their needs. I mean, we sit in this deep life of poverty in South Africa and Africa. As if we don't have the capacity to deal with poverty. So that is the impact that I'm asking for. That if the next time coming show is in the economy, has contributed in terms of enabling industry, it has contributed not just health-wise, but it is making a big difference because factories are open and can compete with the world, and South Africa is richer than what it was before.
Done. Or are you expecting a response? I remember, I thought maybe the meeting is next time. Okay. This debate is very, very interesting. It shows that indeed we have to meet here. And there's another hand from the DGG from the Department of Finance.
Yeah, I won't take long, but I think the Honourable Kitana's very wise comment requires just acknowledgement from our department. To say that we would be very happy to come and brief the portfolio committee either in just the higher education committee or jointly with science technology for you to decide, but we would be very happy to respond to the question that is raised or the observation really that is made, because he's absolutely right. That's really at the heart of developing the high level skills at the universities, so that science and technology and research and development in the country can flourish, so that they can have real socio-economic impact. So we would be very happy to do that. To leave perhaps just one thought with the Honourable Kekana. You were talking about the role of science and technology and research in beneficiation and in moving towards a knowledge economy. These are absolutely key drivers. And it's important to understand that the production of PhD level skill in South Africa in itself is a meaningful contribution in that strategic objective of moving toward a knowledge economy, almost independent of what that project was actually about. Just the development of those skills is absolutely critical to moving toward a knowledge economy. Thank you very much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have now come to the end of our engagement. But then before we close, I really would like to give NFR just an opportunity to give us a closing statement, and NFR will be followed by the DG, and then the co-chair, and then I'll close.
Honourable Chair, I think just to reiterate our thanks for this opportunity to engage with the Committee on Higher Education and Training. I think this is an opportunity that we must take into the future. I think our presentation showed that there is an alignment between what needs to be done and if we are going to make the kind of difference that has been articulated, then it's our responsibility going forward to work together around the challenges and definitely to achieve the kinds of benefits that we want to see for the community. So we are thankful for this opportunity and we'll continue the discussions outside with our partners. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I've also consulted with my co-chair here, who seems to be appropriate at the time, also the official from the Department of Science and Technology, DDG. Over to you, just to give us your closing statement after participating in this robust debate.
Thank you very much. It was a wonderful opportunity for me, and I'd like to think I'm speaking on behalf of my colleague Dr. Matutu as well, to have been able to be here, to be close to the rigor of the debate that the portfolio committee had on these issues. And we're very grateful, as I said, to the two committees for working together like this, and we certainly from our side will do everything that we can to strengthen that relationship and in pursuit of our joint objectives. Thank you.
Thank you. I will now ask the DG to give us a closing statement.
Well, thank you very much, Chair. It's really quite fruitful and empowering, this engagement. And the interventions and all the efforts, the deployment of resources, is seen in the context of addressing some of the pertinent challenges that are confronting the system. But for the country to actually move productively forward, we would have to look at the entire question of education, right from basic education, insofar as producing the quality which is required for registering and admission at universities. And the universities themselves, they would have to ensure that they produce good quality graduates at undergraduate level, so that the pipeline for post-grad is actually enhanced. It's therefore quite important, especially for the members, to hold the entire value day quite accountable. And we should really not be receptive of excuses. We have a lot of excuses in the system. One would say, no, I didn't have this, I didn't have that, but without actually putting measures in place to address those shortcomings. And the money that government is actually pumping into the system is relatively a lot. But the question is to ensure that we get value at every step of the way. Because if I may have to make an example, if there are deficiencies that may be happening at the basic, now when it gets to higher education, it means you must get other resources for intervention programs to address that gap even before you get to other programs at a higher level for enrollment. So it's quite important to look at it in its entirety and hold those who are responsible quite accountable, so that we can be able to maximize the impact that we should be making across the system.
DG, I will now ask my co-chair to make a closing statement.
I realize that I want to be with the chair. I'm here to speak on our behalf, and say, I must say something. I'm obliged. My comment will be to put a question to, not necessarily a question, but a comment directed to ourselves as public representatives, that I think we need to be firm and proactive in terms of the roles that we are supposed to play to ensure that not necessarily the executive coming to account, but also interact with them in such a manner that the things that work, we must make them work better. If you have heard what the response was to the issue of trade, the DGI have taken a decision that no, they're going to do it, IMF, they are going to stop doing it from now onwards. What is the problem with the trade? What are the challenges? Why do we want to bring a new thing? If we have used something for 20 years and it works, well, best can we improve it, rather than throw it away and start something new for another 25 years, for another 30 years. We will end up with people trying new and, you know, sometimes blame other things that are not necessarily the problem. Yes, we are the problem ourselves, you know, not wanting to learn from our own experience. 20 years is a lot. you can't want to behave like you are new when you are 20 years old. I think out of that, you know, the things that are working here, we must make them work. But clearly, there is a need for coordination, you know, not only the Department of Science and Technology and the Department of Higher Education, but it's also important to have a meeting with the trainees and the engineers so that when we discuss TRIM and the need to change, the Department of Higher Education and Training must know. But we think the NRF was doing it okay, there were weaknesses here. Let's improve on the weaknesses. Even if it goes to trade and industry, it must go there being a better vehicle. But clearly we need to coordinate, including with the committee on finance or appropriation, so that as a country we must say this is what we have. Do we want to invest in education or do we want to build R&D? We must choose because we can't do both at the same time. If we want to continue to do everything at the same time, we'll continue investing 10% into higher education for postgrad and continue to pay 25% of undergrad students, and you will have students who will drop out of school because they can't pay off. Yesterday, I was talking to a student who sent me a SMS that she has a problem. She's at university. MSF says they don't have money, so they are not going to pay for her. So she's not going to go to school, but we are going to build an RMP house. Is that how we want to handle or to approach the future of this country? I think at some point it will be important that we coordinate and come together and see what is it that we agree should happen. Because as public representatives, we have the authority to redirect how the resources of the country are supposed to be allocated. We are not in a fair pattern. We should be able to say, no, we think this budget, this is what must happen. This thing of also saying that when people must pay 5,000 for registration before they access the fund is madness. Because it means that kids from poor families, before they are helped by this government, they must first pay, but they don't have the money to pay for that 5,000 because they don't have. Why don't they accept that themselves without having to pay? And that, you know, we need to look at this and agree that we should work differently. Our meeting was very good. But we must not meet today as we meet next year. When there is something we want to clarify from RRF or want education to say something which then necessitates another committee. Probably at the level of chair, it might be important to identify a point where chairs must meet and other committees that are relevant to each other must meet because we must assist the departments to meet, come together because sometimes they don't. You know, you heard when you were speaking. I don't know your name next to the acting CEO. You were saying when they look at the policy, at the National Development Plan, Science and Technology Board, and look at their own thing and say, this is what we are going to do. And ourselves as DHET, we look at it and say, this will be our priority. And sometimes they end up coming at two different things that are speaking to one thing, interpreting one thing, but they have got two approaches which don't necessarily talk to each other. And I think it's a bit of a disjuncture, and we need to find a way also as public representatives to come in and make our own little contribution to the growth and development of our own country. Thanks very much.
Well, I must thank the committee for having realized the importance of us coming together. So that together, if we work together, we can do more. That is flowing from statements by Koche. Well, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, what brought us together this morning is Outcome 5, which is a skilled and capable workforce to support an inclusive growth path. NRF being a key stakeholder to the accomplishment of this mission, it is clear that as this committee working together with NRF and DHET, had to converge here this morning to learn and gain deeper insight on what is happening, what plans are in place to make sure that the NDP that describes a 5,000 doctoral graduates per annum by 2030 is implemented, is successfully implemented. Also to learn from you the challenges that you are confronted with and the risks are identified. Not only that, to also, because at a higher echelon, you are expected to come with solutions. You were right, Tishi, when you said, excuse me. It's not what we wanted to hear from you. Because so that you can hear where you identified that, what is that you are doing to close those gaps as early as now so that you can move and smoothly with the implementation of this MDP. Of course, we have to come and learn from you, TG, how you are going to make sure that we do not plunge the country into a crisis in the institutions of higher learning training 7 years down the line. We don't want to say, yes, this was in the NDP 7 years down the line, we have not done anything. So we thought we should trigger a response. Come and hear what you're doing and trigger a response from SAS now in this committee, the two committees. Well, we are encouraged as this committee, the joint committee, sitting and the council to know that the Department of Higher Education and Training has adopted and officially launched the Starting South Africa's University Framework. We are very much encouraged. And there is concern by members of the committee on the responsiveness of the Department of Higher Education and Training to the needs in the higher education and training sector. We can hope by the framework that supports to redress the imbalances of the past by prioritizing women, people with disabilities, and black academics. The contractual obligation by the Department of Higher Education and Training and universities to retain these academics in their respective universities is commended. It is a commitment. We will be monitoring on the actual implementation of this commitment as a committee to oversight over the department. We would like to appeal to the Department of Higher Education and Training to ensure that all universities have staff retention strategy and this is implemented to the latter. This input was triggered by the input raised by Professor Kulisa on presently asking the academics due to disparities in their salaries. So if this can be attended to so that we don't lose instead of increase, we will appreciate it. We welcome the reprioritization of the Teaching and Development Branch to fund NRF, and we will discourage NRF from taking this branch. I'm moving from the experience that the National Treasury has come and again complained that the grants are not being fully utilized. So I'm using this information to say, please use this one fully. It must not be saved, because it is there, must then the plan, must be linked to the plan so that the law plan is fully implemented. We cannot agree more with collaboration and partnerships with all the key stakeholders, inclusive of NSF, National Skills Fund, NRF, and universities, which is critical for the successful implementation of this program. Well, from the NRF, the key issues that I picked up are, we would like to commend the work of the National Research Foundation, and indeed the department cannot achieve the NDP targets without the support of the National Research Foundation. This came from different members of the community. You can see that indeed there was emphasis here to say, indeed without you, the department you know, we're not going to be able to meet its NPP targets. So you can see how much we rely on you here, so that we proceed and we achieve on these targets. Well, there's indeed lessons to learn from all the projects implemented by NRF, like Tutunga. They sounded very good, and it's clear that you really are on top of the situation. So all of us here, there are lessons to learn from you. I think I must commend them. But then, now that I've commended you, may I please also ask that you should not be complacent. There's a problem. You know, you really want to give incentives, but some fellows will give the incentives then. But I trust you. I know you won't be complacent. You have a good work. The king knows that the NRF has not reached transformation targets at master's, doctoral, and postdoctoral programs on RISA program. We would urge the NRF to fast-track transformation in this regard. Everybody now, during this period of a radical social economic transformation, is expected to fast-track. I think there's somewhere where I really wanted to make people feel that I really mean it. I said, but it is fast track. Okay, it will come. I said it when it comes. Oh, I said fast forward. Just very fast forward. I thought I wanted to, you know, just in front to say, hey, just move forward. 21 years down the line, you're still talking transformation. Why is it slow? We are now in this period, which means everybody is now expected to engage fast track so that we can achieve in terms of the transformation that we all engage. We also note and welcome international collaboration and partnerships that are yielding positive results in terms of producing postgraduate students and doctoral graduates in particular. As we know that we desperately need this for economic growth and development of the country. This point was very clear in the DG opening remarks. It did not mean to it, but this is what we need this for. Economic growth and the development of the country. As I conclude, let me thank NFR. Did I say NFR? I'm sorry, I'm putting the other way around. National Research Foundation, the Department of Science and Technology, the committee, Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology, Gigi and your team, for your meaningful and constructive engagement. It is true, let's continue engaging one another until, you know, all the challenges of this country are met. Only when we work together that we can fast-track and be able to achieve all these challenges. I'd like to thank the honorable members for your meaningful engagement, and it is true that I have nothing else to ask you for. So with this few words, I would like to wish all of you all of the all your endeavors. Thank you very much. Now the meeting between ourselves now has come to an end. I will give a short break, 5 minutes short break, so that you can quietly or simply move out. There's pieces outside, please do help yourself, otherwise there will be a wasteful expenditure. Okay? And then to the honorable members, we'll be coming back as the stuff is that has to finish. Thank you.
to visit Easter.